using free speech to free minds. You're listening to The David Knight Show.
It's Friday, September 10th, year of our Lord 2021. 20 years, almost to the day, of 9/11. And so today we're going to take a look not only at the New World Order holding us all hostage, but we're also going to take a look at how 20 years later, you know, as Bush said, they hate us for our freedom. That has literally become true. Joe Biden hates you for your freedom. And he made it very clear yesterday. He said, this is not about freedom. This is not about your personal choice. We'll see about that. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're also going to be joined in the third hour with some people from the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Truth about some recent legal filings. And folks, what you need to understand also is I've had, these are going to be different people than I've talked to in the past from the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Truth. They realize, as I hope you do as a listener of this program, that it's not just 9/11. There was another shoe that dropped. That shoe dropped last year. And it dropped on our face, and these tyrants have been kicking us and hitting us in the face with their shoes, stomping on our face with their feet, their boots, just as George Orwell said, for the last year and a half. And so we're going to take a look at what this looks like 545 days after this second shoe dropped on us. We're going to take a look at the a little bit at the commemoration ceremonies and how they're maneuvering with that, but primarily going to take a look at what has happened with the surveillance and war complex over the last year, 20 years, and how it has turned inward on us. And then we're also going to take a look, a quick review, back at the truth about 9/11 and the efforts to get to that. And again, as I said, in the third hour, we're going to have people from the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Truth. We're going to have David Meiswinkel. And we're also going to have the litigation director, Mick Harrison. David Meiswinkel is the president and executive director of Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. So I want to begin today, however, with the amazing statement that President Trump, President Biden, it's hard to tell the two of them apart, actually, quite frankly. I predicted last year. And I said, regardless of who the president was, we're going to get to this moment that we're at right now. I said, you realize they're going to make it available. I said it was going to be in the fall. I knew it was going to be in the fall because it's going to focus around the schools and as a lead up to cold and flu season. So I was pretty confident of that. I also told you, because it was said from the very beginning by the medical dictators planning this, New England Journal of Medicine and others were saying, we don't want to have due process challenges, so we don't want to mandate this stuff. We want to run it through the corporations. And, of course, corporate mandates are a part of that. And now the corporate mandates have just landed with Biden. He cannot, he's not going to hold up if he tries to directly mandate this. Although, if you test it to the Supreme Court, who knows what they will do, right? We had the Obamacare mandate. They found a prevarication to say that they could force you to buy a particular type of insurance from private insurance companies. There clearly was no authority for that. They wiggled around and called it a tax. And even after they removed the penalty, which they called the tax, which is said, well, see, it's not, we're not forcing you to buy something. We're just telling you we're going to tax you if you don't do it. So you see the kind of games that they play. That's why I said yesterday, do not rely on the court systems. And I'm glad that we got some governors who are saying, not in my state. I haven't seen anything about Biden, interesting, not Biden, Abbott, interestingly enough, saying that. But we're going to take a look at what Biden actually had to say. He's going to have massive fines. So one of the things that I tweeted out yesterday was I said, well, even if you assume that he had the authority to coerce corporations to do this through the Labor Department, these fines of $14,000 would be prohibited under the Eighth Amendment for excessive fines. But they're also going to ramp up fines for people who don't wear masks to $3,000. Now, we've seen people who have been arbitrarily charged by the FAA. This is not due process we're talking about here. These are fines that are being applied to people by the TSA or by the FAA. And there is no due process. There's no presumption of innocence, and there's no protection against excessive fines. Why? Because this is coming from the regulatory state, that they say. So they're bumping this up to $3,000, but we've seen people charged over $20,000 because they said, well, not only were you not wearing a mask, but you got rude with a flight attendant who was, you know, really getting into the power trip here. And so several people have been fined over $20,000. But, you know, just anybody not wearing a mask, $3,000 instantly. That's excessive. They're going to try to deny you your due process. So we're going to talk a little bit about ways that we're going to push back against this, because as I tweeted out yesterday and put at the top of my account on Twitter, I said, let's be clear. I don't need a quote-unquote exemption. Government has neither the authority nor the power to compel me to inject anything into my body. I said about 8 years ago on air talking about this stuff. I said, you want to try to, and we knew this was coming then. That was when they were ramping up all kinds of stuff for the kids. I said, you want to try to inject your stuff? You want to shoot me up with whatever you decide you want to shoot me up with? Well, you know, I've got things that shoot too. They shoot lead. They don't shoot genetic code injections, but they shoot lead. You try to inject stuff into my body, I will inject stuff into your body. It's just that simple. This is the line. This is about my personal choice. This is about freedom. It is absolutely about freedom. It's about freedom. It's about excessive authority. You had Doug Wilson put out an op-ed piece. We all see this coming. He did it about a week and a half ago. He said, don't take the bait. And he said, by the way, don't take the bait. And he just keeps repeating, don't take the bait. In other words, do not initiate any force. And I would suggest that you be very careful what you do. Do not do anything that could be construed to initiate force. We can operate in our parallel society. I don't need to fly. I don't need to work for a corporation. And neither do you. We can fight this in any number of ways. I think it'd be great if we had a national strike and everybody walked off the job. These people are using us. You think Biden can do anything by himself? He probably can't wipe his behind by himself or tie his shoes. They got to tell him everything. Well, I'm supposed to say this at this point in time. He doesn't know what he's doing. And the rest of those people up there in Washington are just as helpless. They can't grow food. They can't do anything. They can't program a computer. They can't do anything. You name it. All of the practical stuff that's being done by those of us on the bottom. And these people continue to mandate toxic poisons being injected into us and our children. Just walk away from them. Let's see them. Let's see how they can survive. These people can't even manufacture the tests that they want everybody to take. It's a clown show. Trump doesn't build buildings. He moves money around in politicians' pockets. All these people do is influence, give orders. They move money around. Well, we need to move them around. White House official says the U.S. postal workers are not included in President Biden's vaccine requirement. What is the, that's a massive chunk of the federal workforce. What's the bottom line here? You know, I'm not a big union supporter, but there comes a time when we have to come together to fight collectively for our individual liberty. And that means that we'd simply say, If this is a federal union that's got 644,000 people in it. And they say, no, we'll just stop delivering the mail. If we hang together, if we refuse to comply, that's what I'm talking about, refusing to comply. If we do that, we can stop these people. you want to see Biden and Jen Psaki delivering mail? Yeah, right. He said, this is not about freedom or personal choice. It's about protecting yourself and those around you, the people you work with, the people you care about, the people you love. My job as president is to protect all Americans, he said. No, that's not your job. Your job is to defend our liberty. The purpose of government. That's one of the things, the other things that I tweeted out yesterday. I said, they are continue to push this. I tweeted out a picture of the full document of the Declaration of Independence. And then just so they understand, I took a screenshot of the preamble, the second part of the preamble that they don't want you to memorize in school. I highlighted it. I underlined it. There it is right there. Click on that white button right there. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, that is to protect your life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, right? Whenever any government becomes destructive of these ends, it is a right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government. And that's exactly what we have to do at this point in time. Biden mandate for federal employees, except for postal workers, because they have a union that'll stand up for them. No option to opt out through testing. Remove that. He already did that for people flying into the country. Right? It doesn't matter if you get a test. You got to be vaccinated to fly in the country. So, unless you were Afghan. If you're Afghan, we don't worry about any of that, right? We'll give you some ivermectin. Don't give you a vaccine. Don't give you a test. Probably don't give them a mask either. They don't even know who they are, right? Bring them in by the tens of the thousands. Psaki says all federal employees have 75 days to get vaccinated or face getting fired. The unions say they were kept out of negotiations on a new mandate and their workers deserve a voice. Do you understand how desperate these globalist puppets are in every country? The Democrats are going to war with the unions. The Democrats are going to war with the federal government unions over this. Now, they may be able to buy off the leaders, who knows, but the leaders are speaking out about this already. That's how desperate they are. It doesn't matter what happens. They are hell-bent on making sure each and every person gets the genetic code injection. That in and of itself, that desperation, it ought to be the big red flag for you to say, I'm not going to do this. So he has moved this to any company that has more than 100 employees. I find that interesting. Do you remember when we had the PPP, Payroll Protection Plan, except it was really big government and big business, PPPing down your back and telling you it was raining? But they said, we're going to do this for small businesses. Small businesses are businesses that have 500 employees or less. And then Steve Mnuchin and Donald Trump said, well, wait a minute. We got these hotels, we got other things. We need to redefine that so that it's no more than 500 employees per location. Per location. So in other words, anybody other than a large manufacturing facility, and we don't have large manufacturing facilities anymore here. So all the money basically went to the big guys. More than 50% of the money went to 5% of the companies that were very big. So for the purposes of handing out cash, a small business is somebody that has fewer than 500 employees at a given location. Is that going to apply with Biden? In other words, there's this mandate, and he says, well, it's going to be for any company that has 100 employees. Well, is that 100 employees per location, or is that 100 employees altogether? In other words, does it apply to McDonald's, for example? I know there's McDonald's franchisees, and they may not have more than 100 employees for all their different locations. But, you know, you do have company-owned stores for a lot of these fast food places as well. So are they going to play that per-location game, or are they going to just aggregate it? They probably will aggregate it, because we have one standard when it's time for money to be handed out, the carrots. And then when it's time for the government to hit us with sticks, they go to a different standard. And so let's take a look at some of the things that Biden had to say. Here's him explaining that he not only hates your freedoms, but he hates the unvaccinated. You have to understand, 20 years ago, we were going after the phantom attackers who had come out of the caves and flown the planes into buildings to collapse them. You know, and just, you know, three buildings with just two planes, for example, in New York. So they were public enemy number one. But here we are 20 years later, and it's the unvaxxed that they're trying to keep us locked up in our caves. We are the enemy. We are the domestic terrorists. They've now pivoted to domestic terrorism. That's what I'm going to talk about in the aftermath of 20 years of this. And this second shoe dropping, the pandemic, which was there right at the beginning, all the way through, intricately tied into 9/11 back in 2001. But here's what Biden has to say about who the current enemy is. This is far more important to him than anything else.
We read about and hear about and we see the stories of hospitalized people on their deathbeds among the unvaccinated over the past few weeks. This is a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
Okay, a pandemic of the unvaccinated. How many times have we heard that lie repeated? And of course, that's the key, is to repeat the lie, to make it big. A big repeated lie becomes the truth with the power of mass media. He went on to say, we still have nearly 80 million Americans that failed to get the shot. And to make matters worse, there are elected officials actively working to undermine the fight against COVID-19. Let me tell you who the underminer is. I am the underminer. Yeah, I'm beneath you, but nothing is beneath me, right? That's Biden. Biden, well, actually his people, whoever's writing his scripts, whoever's telling this senile puppet what to do. But he goes on to say they're a 25% minority, and that 25% can cause a lot of damage. You wait, and you see how much damage we can cause, you SOB. So he goes on to try to support this, and he says, on the summer, based on our data, well, let's see your data. We're going to fact-check this data here. He said, only one out of every 160,000 fully vaccinated Americans were hospitalized for COVID per day. All right, let's take the numbers that we've got here. He says 80 million of people who are failed to get the shot, and then immediately he starts talking about 100 million. So I don't know. Is it 80 million? Is it 100 million? Let's be charitable to Biden's argument here. Let's say that it's true. Let's just assume that it is true that one out of every 160,000 fully vaccinated Americans is being hospitalized for COVID every day. Well, that'd be pretty damning, wouldn't it, about the efficacy of that stupid shot? And it's not just one, it's two. When have we ever had a vaccine where you had two shots? And even with two shots, I can't do it. So they're going to do the third one by September the 20th. And this is what all of you who maybe may see your resolve weakening over what is coming. As we told our friends who now realize that he has myocarditis and many other heart issues, but he just can't get any medical professionals to admit it except whispering it to them, you know, wearing the mask. I know, it's this is horrible. But nobody has the backbone to stand up to this. How do we get any treatment, they said. And in the meantime, AT&T is saying, you know, we got a promotion for you, but you're going to have to accept the fact that you're going to get the next shot as well, even though this has nearly killed you and may wind up killing him. Because when you have heart damage, as Dr. Told us, Lee Merritt, she said, you understand the life expectancy of people who've had myocarditis is about 5 years or so. Heart damage is something that you don't recover from. And that's especially true of all these young people who are getting it. So they said, you're going to commit to the second shot or you're going to be fired. You commit to the second shot, we'll give you a promotion. And I contacted him and I said, you know, it's not just two shots. Fauci said the third one is going to be approved September 20th in another week. They're already doing four in Israel. I've seen cards. People sent me snapshots of their cards. Hey, did you notice this? It's got eight slots on here. And that doesn't mean it's limited to eight. The definition of fully vaxxed is constantly going to be changing. It's going to be the Babylon Bee had a satire about a month ago. Join the Pfizer Plus, you know, just for a monthly subscription, you get a vaccine every month, and you also get some great merchandise with a Pfizer logo on it, you know, just like Stephen Colbert. So it's not going to change, right? You are submitting to a system that's going to continue to inject you until it kills you. It's going to continue to inject you with every possible thing they can imagine. No limits. You're establishing a precedent. They already talked about how the precedent had been established in 2019 that they didn't have to honor religious or medical exemptions for children. Remember that? Do you remember that?
They have to get the shot. The vaccinations are so important. This is really going around now.
You see, the purpose of that, what was happening in 2019 was they'd already said, well, we're going to, and you hear these people saying, well, you know, vaccines have been mandated for schools for a long time. Well, not if you had a religious exemption or if you had a medical exemption. 2019 was about removing that. That's what Trump was doing right there, removing the religious and medical exemptions. Do you understand? And so that was the harbinger of what was coming. It's very clear. Very clear. And so the harbinger of what is to come is that if you join this beast system, they will continue to inject you with everything. Immunization Agenda 2030. Bill Gates. By 2030, he wants everyone, everywhere, every age under his thumb, doing everything that he says, getting every injection that they can dream up. Oh, well, now we got a new one. This one is going to, it's going to cure cancer. Well, I know we had some breakthrough cancer cases, but, you know, by and large, it's really good. Yeah, I know some people drop dead within 24 hours, but it's really good, and you need to, but you're going to have to get it or you're going to be kicked out of the beast system. So you want to accept that slavery? You want to accept that? Precedents matter. What Trump did in 2019 matters. And what you're doing right now matters. So let's go with the numbers. Let's assume that this is right. Let's assume that there's out of every 160,000 fully vaccinated people, one is hospitalized per day. Now, Biden doesn't say how that compares to the unvaccinated. So let's do that comparison. Let's make some assumptions. He said 80 million people are going to be affected by this. Other places he said 100. Let's go with the lower amount here, 80. And so then that would mean that he's got 250 million vax people, right? Assuming we've got a population of about 330 million people here. So with 250 million vaxed people, and again, this is making assumptions that are in the favor of what Biden is wanting to do, which is to show that the vaccinated people are not going to the hospital. So with 250 million vaxed people, and one out of every 160,000 is going to the hospital every day. That means that you've got 1,500 vaxxed people going to the hospital every day. 1,500 every day. Let's take a look at the unvaxxed. Okay, well, if there's 250 million vaxxed, that means that there'd be 80 million unvaxxed. So how many people per 160,000 would be going to the hospital each day? Well, that would be... would we expect to see 500 unvaxxed going to the hospital every day? Be about a third of that, you know, if we look at the same ratio. Are they the ones that are overwhelming society? And, of course, what we're looking at here is just a ratio of vaxxed to unvaxxed. You know, we're saying about a third of the people. So he doesn't make a case that the unvaxxed are at a higher percentage. So if they're about the same percentage, they're about a third of the people going to the hospital. And we got about 153,000 cases being identified every day. Now, these are not people being going to the hospital. These are people who are getting the phony PCR tests, the PCR tests that are magnifying any viral debris in your body by a trillion times. And we've got 59 different PCR tests that are looking for 59 different viral profiles. Some of them are synthetic mRNA, according to the FDA and its evaluation of these tests. They said we got 59 of them. We can't really compare their efficacy to each other because they're all testing for something different. We didn't have the virus, so we just decided, and we still don't have any isolated viruses, they said. So we just decided that we would synthesize some mRNA. Sometimes we'd use mRNA fragments, sometimes we'd use whole mRNA. And everybody just gets to pick what they want to test for, and then we magnify it by a trillion times. And on the basis of that, they've identified 153,000 cases on a daily basis. This is the current 7-day average, 153,000 cases. Well, that's if you're looking at how many people are being hospitalized, okay, that's about 1%. Of the cases that are being hospitalized are that are being identified are going to the hospital from the vaccinated. They make up about 1% of these cases there. So he's trying to make the case that the unvaccinated are somehow dangerous, but we don't know that all of the rest of the people who are unvaccinated are going to the hospital. As a matter of fact, they aren't. These are just the number of cases that are there each day. So he doesn't give you any information. He just tells you, well, it's only one out of 160,000. I don't think that's very good, frankly. Nothing to brag about. And he doesn't say how many it is for the unvaccinated, but he says it's a pandemic of the unvaccinated. So we don't have to question him, right? He goes on to talk about how he is going to apply the penalties. But, you know, we have to reduce, he said, we can reduce the number of unvaccinated Americans. We must increase vaccinations among unvaccinated. See, that's how you do it. He's got this figured out. The way you reduce the number of unvaccinated Americans is you increase the vaccinations. See, got 80 million people or we got 100 million people. We're not really sure. I mean, you know, what does it matter? Give or take 20 million people, right? This is the way they're throwing these numbers around. None of this. There's so many different assumptions that you can make on all these numbers. That's my point. But here's what he has to say in terms of the penalties.
So tonight, I'm announcing that the Department of Labor is developing an emergency rule to require all employers with 100 or more employees that together employ over 80 million workers to ensure their workforces are fully vaccinated or show a negative test at least once a week. Department of Labor
two
will
shots,
require
three shots, four shots.
Employers with 100 or more workers to give those workers paid time off to get vaccinated. No one should lose pay in order to get vaccinated or take a loved one to get vaccinated. Today, in total, the vaccine requirements in my plan will affect about 100 million Americans.
Well, isn't that nice? And it's so compassionate, too. We're going to tell employers, you get these people vaccinated or a $14,000 fine. And by the way, you're going to give them time off to go get vaccinated. Isn't that generous? Did you hear him say he's going to give them time off when they get sick? What about nobody he says should have to take time off in order to get vaccinated? Well, I would say nobody should have to risk getting disabled for life. Nobody should have to risk their life, risk death, in order to get vaccinated. And where's the compensation for any of that? Nowhere to be found. Nowhere to be found. They have made sure that the vaccine companies are not going to be held liable for it. I don't know what the situation is going to be for the employers. You know, the employer is going to weigh whether or not they're going to get a $14,000 fine or a lawsuit from the relatives that they coerced into getting a vaccine when their medical conditions said otherwise. So he says, let me be blunt. My plan also takes on elected officials in states that are undermining you and these life-saving actions. And he just keeps repeating himself. Undermining unvaccinated. Right now, local school officials are trying to keep children safe in a pandemic, but these people are in the way. And then after he delivers his scripted remarks by his handlers, he just turned around, walked away from the podium, taking no questions, as he always does. As a reporter is shouting, is this constitutional? Well, Biden announced that he has natural immunity to the Constitution, says the Babylon Bee. The great line. But let me tell you, I said when Biden was running that he is the most hostile person to individual liberty that I've ever seen in all the years I've been watching politics. I talked about how during the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, he came after Clarence Thomas, not because of this Anita Hill nonsense. He came after Clarence Thomas because Clarence Thomas had written some papers talking about natural rights. Natural rights. Not natural immunity, but natural rights. He was outraged by that. Joe Biden has always been one of the most authoritarian, anti-liberty people in Washington. He is proudly co-author of gun control, assault bans, also the war on drugs issues, and all of the Patriot Act stuff. But with the war on drugs, even though that was passed under the Reagan administration, Ed Meese, Reagan's attorney general, was pushing that very hard. It was really Biden who came up with the stuff like civil asset forfeiture, who came up with the mandatory minimums that filled our prisons up with a lot of people who were just smoking pot. Nonviolent, not dealing, just smoking pot. And based on the quantity, Joe Biden wanted them locked up. It was a big boon to the prison industry. And that's where this guy is ultimately going. That's why I keep talking about these green zones and everything. The guy who gave us the measures in the war on drugs that caused America to lock up more people per capita than any other country on earth because of the drug war, that was Joe Biden's doing. And so he's on board with that, even though he is not in control doing this. I also tweeted out yesterday, I said, I think Biden has jumped the shark in requiring all companies with more than 100 employees to mandate vaccines or negative tests. This will be a Pfizer dictatorship if we allow this. I also said the Supreme Court, the entire court system, is not reliable. Taking your stuff to court and trusting that you're going to get these federal officials to have the right kind of ruling is another form of Russian roulette, just like taking the vaccine. You might as well stick a gun to your head and pull the trigger. SCOTUS is not reliable at protecting the Constitution, not reliable at protecting individual liberty. So what do we do? It's the same thing I've been saying from the very beginning. We have to use the 10th Amendment. We have to use nullification. Fortunately, we do have some Republicans because they did jump the shark on this. And I also said this. I said last fall that this was going to happen now. They'll be coercing it through the corporations. Here it is. They're coercing it through the corporations and then mandating it for all the people that are working for them. That's precisely what is happening. It was so obvious. For the military, for all the federal employees, they're mandating it. They're going to use this. They're going to coerce people to get an education. We'd already seen that back in 2019. No exceptions, no medical or religious exemptions. And then they will coerce it through the corporations. Right now, for all the corporations, 100 employees, you got to get the vaccine or a weekly test. Let me tell you, the weekly test thing is going to go away just like it did on the flights coming in. And that arbitrary number of 100 employees that's already lower than what they consider to be a small business at 500, they can just arbitrarily take that down. They can make it 10. We've seen them do this with occupancy of buildings as well, right? Well, you can't have more than 150 people. Well, now you can't have more than 15% of the capacity of the building. Then they take it down to 150 people. Then they take it down to 15 people. They're going to play that same game. So you have to understand the precedent that's being set here. This is a game of boil the frogs. So social media erupts with, "I will not comply," and some other more choice words that were applied out there on social media. The RNC has vowed that they will sue. Again, that's not the solution. Do everything. I'm not saying don't sue. Absolutely. Who knows? You might get lucky. You might, put one bullet in the chamber, spin it, and, point it at Biden, and maybe the real bullet will come out. I don't know. That's all you're going to get from the court system, though. Biden unveils the most severe COVID actions yet, coming for all large private companies. That's the headline, but that's not really it. I mean, it's not large companies. 500 was the cutoff, the beginning of small to large companies. This is down to 100 already. It's going to rapidly escalate from there. And again, elected officials and states are undermining these life-saving actions. He said, well, you just wait, because Republicans, such as Ron DeSantis, that he was focused on, others like Kristi Noem will take up this mantle. And that was the other thing I said a year ago. I said, you're going to see, and we started to see a little bit of pushback against this lockdown, against the masking, against the mandates. When did that happen? Let me ask you, when did that happen? Did that happen in March of 2020? Did it happen in July of 2020? Did it happen in the fall up to the election? No. Didn't hear anything from Republicans objecting to that. Not at all. Did it happen after the election? No. We were still running around trying to figure out how we could audit the election and keep Donald Trump in office. And I said, as long as he's in office, the Republicans will do nothing to oppose these globalist mandates. I said, the only chance that you've got that there'll be any opposition at all, and it has been very limited in terms of its opposition. I said, the only chance you're going to have any opposition at all will be if that Pied Piper is out of office. And they will oppose it because it's in their partisan interest to do that. They'll find it as a little bit of a wedge issue. And unfortunately, we've seen that they don't go all in on these issues, just like, they have on so many other issues. But they will oppose it now because it's coming from Biden. If Trump had been in, there would be no opposition. If Trump is saying, well, we're going to do this to corporations, they might have given the corporations some money instead of some penalties. You see the difference between Democrats and Republicans? They would have offered the corporations probably carrots instead of sticks. But otherwise, I can't see that there would have been any difference. And I'm telling you, there would not have been. But now we're going to have some Republicans like DeSantis and Kristi Noem. Noem threatening to mount a legal challenge. That's not the answer. I think in Florida, they will be a little bit more direct, hopefully, in terms of nullifying this. Again, the solution is nullification. It is the 10th Amendment. It is to have local officials, if we can find any, with a backbone and a spine who will stand up to this. And maybe we can only find them at the local level. I'm not sure they exist at the state level. The ACLU has been taking the sides of the mandates everywhere. The American Civil Liberties Union. Now, I've watched the ACLU, and I know it was a fraudulent organization. It was run by some very liberal, Democrat-leaning, very socially liberal New York Jewish guys, and they would come. Ira Glasser was the head of it, and then there was Nadine Strasser. She would be the one that would come to the libertarian conventions, and you'd always have some libertarian say, oh, I'm proud to be a card-carrying member of the ACLU, and it's like, I'm not giving them a cent. I'm not giving them a cent, because they could not, for example, in those days, back in the late 80s, early 90s, only Nadine Strasser could uncomfortably agree to the principles of the Second Amendment, but she was very uncomfortable with it. Ira Glasser just ignored it, and doesn't exist. You don't have a right. This is talking about the National Guard. And it's like, yeah, okay. So I'm not surprised to see the American. They would always refuse. For example, even though the Libertarian Party would love to invite Nadine to speak every national convention, they would always refuse to stand up for the rights of a candidate who is legitimately on the ballot. You got three candidates on the ballot, but we can't have a three-candidate debate. No, it'll only be the Democrats and Republicans, and they would never stand up and fight that. They would, on the other hand, since they were predominantly Jewish, they would stand up for the rights of Nazis to march in Skokie, Illinois, a predominantly Jewish town. And so they could virtue signal and they could break their arm, patting themselves on the back, saying, even though we're Jewish, we support the free speech, even when we disagree with it and we don't like it and it's hurtful and hateful, we support that. No, they didn't. That was just virtue signaling. They didn't support something as basic and fundamental as including all the candidates in the debates. And so now the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit in August to overturn South Carolina's ban on mask mandates. So in other words, they're fighting this to make masks mandated. And amazingly enough, the argument that the ACLU is making is that that ban on mask mandates violates the Americans with Disabilities Act. The Americans with Disabilities Act is about helping people who have health issues, right? Fundamentally. We have people with asthma being forced to wear masks. That's a big deal. My father struggled with asthma all of his life. All of his life. I had a cousin who died from an asthma attack working in her garden. She couldn't get to her inhaler quickly enough. That's a big deal. You don't put a mask on somebody like that. We got other people who have respiratory illnesses, but they're not going to acknowledge that. This is not about medicine. It is not about health. This is about dictatorship. It's about doctors' orders. And I don't care when you start giving orders. I don't care if you're wearing a brown shirt or a white lab coat. I don't take orders. And you don't have the authority to give them. And if they're concerned about people with disabilities, and if they're concerned they don't want to create people with more disabilities, they wouldn't be giving this to people who already have immune diseases, and they're crippling them. And people who are healthy, they're giving immune diseases and crippling them. But we've got a lot of people with medical conditions, so the ACLU says, no, we need to have this, because the masks are going to protect the vast majority of people, and we're going to throw the individual under the bus. Well, no, that's true. The science underlying that is even false. 3/4 of unvaxxed Americans say they would quit their job if the shot is required. So, again, if we were to hang together, if we all quit our jobs, you know, you got McDonald's is already closing. Location. They can't. Kentucky Fried Chicken can't get chicken. McDonald's has got other shortages. Chick-fil-A is closing locations because they can't get enough employees. You better prepare, because things are going to get bad. Even if people don't work collectively to protect individual liberty, you understand a lot of people are going to be leaving their jobs, and we're going to see a lot more shortages. That's the bottom line for all of us. We need to be more self-reliant. You need to stock up right now, because the shortages of everything are coming. Everything. This is intended. They want to break us. They want to break the economy. Last year, the focus was on breaking Main Street businesses, middle-class businesses. Then in the fall, it shifted to taking away property from the middle class. 45% of the people that were locked out, had taken out a loan and were renting that, sub-renting that to somebody. That was 45% of the landlords, are small people like that. And so they put a CDC said, you don't have to pay them rent, creating a balloon note problem that now they've removed, and now the banks can foreclose, and the banks will foreclose on these small middle-class landlords who don't have the money to catch up on the arrears. That was always the plan, too. Now they're moving to the employees. After they've gotten rid of a lot of middle-class businesses, they're going to use these big businesses to mandate the vaccines or to kick us out. This is designed to break the system. We have a very fragile system. Production is distributed to a lot of different places. So you make a little bit of it here, you take it over to this other place, you transport it to another place, you do a little bit more work to another place, you do a little bit more work. Everything is just-in-time delivery. You break that chain of production, that complicated infrastructure chain of production, at one point, and you break it all. That's why we're starting to see all these different shortages showing up somewhere. Biden says, show a little bit of respect. And he doubles the fines that TSA agents can hand out at their discretion, of course. You know, I'm just going to write you up. No due process, no trial by jury, no presumption of innocence, and no protection against excessive fines because, hey, this isn't the law. This is just a dictate from your dictator, from Biden. And then he's telling his minions, you know, the flying monkeys telling you that you can't fly, that you can get a $3,000 fine if you break the rules. Be prepared to pay, he said. So just for being unmasked, and of course, if you get an attitude about it, FAA will take it up to over $20,000. Republicans are saying it is time to resist. Yes, absolutely unconstitutional, zero authority to do it. Well, that's all true. Tennessee Republican Robbie Starbuck said that it is time to resist. He said, Biden's overreach cannot go unchecked. Now is the time to fight for our voters, for freedoms, and America. Hillbilly elegy author J.D. Vance, running for Senate in Ohio, said the mandates are morally reprehensible. He dubbed Biden a geriatric tyrant. He said, treating millions of Americans as if they're nothing more than vermin. That's right, we are, you know, we're the rats who are spreading the disease, to be ruled by him and his family. Do not comply, he said. This isn't a fight against vaccines. This is a fight for whether we have America or whether we don't. Now, that is true. I mean, the vaccines are just the initial thing here. They will be able to mandate anything to you. And any number of vaccines, and any kind of vaccine, all of them without being tested. A pundit, Candace Owen, engaged in a flight of fancy, wondering what would happen if all the federal employees refused to play ball with dictator Biden and went on strike. Yeah, we'll see. You know, he's taken on the federal unions. We'll see if they play ball or not. But do you notice a trend here? Robbie Starbuck is running for Congress. J.D. Vance is running for Senate. Do you see any of the already elected Republicans and senators saying anything about this? I see a lot of crickets. I see in this article from RT, one quote after another of candidates who are running for office, nothing from those that have already achieved that status. And that tells you that you're on your own. You really are. Because I'm telling you that once these people get elected, they're going to do a Trump pirouette. One person responded to one of these people, said, well, no vaccination, no job. It's just that simple. Don't like it? Well, enjoy panhandling on a street. So it's a good thing your fascist Pfizer opinions don't matter, your fascist Pfizers. So another one said, funny how all the millions of people working all of this time were okay and appreciated until Biden decided that they weren't. As a matter of fact, Biden had said, and so had Jen Psaki, well, I'm not going to mandate that. You know, we're not going to do it, you know. Trump said he wasn't going to mandate. Biden said he wasn't going to mandate. And I said they're going to coerce it through the corporations, which is what's happening, but he's mandated it for everybody that's underneath him. Funny how all the millions of people working were just fine. I said, including all the frontline heroes who worked for 545 days now without getting vaxxed, and they determined, based on what they saw on the front lines, that their choice would be they'd rather take their risk with the virus that they've been working with for the last 545 days than with the vaccine, because they've been on the front line seeing the effects of both of those. One person, again, Anthony Sabatini, he is an elected state official, and I don't think this is just campaign rhetoric. He's done some good things in Florida. But he said, Florida must call a special session to nullify Biden's vaccine mandates. And this is key. The other people that you're hearing saying, he's just a senile old man, and they're calling him names and saying he doesn't have the authority to do that. Who has the authority to stop him, and what is the means? Anthony Sabatini got it right. If you call special session, you can nullify this. He does not have the authority under the Constitution. The Ninth and Tenth Amendments say that you don't have any authority that isn't specifically enumerated to you. And anything that we haven't specifically enumerated and given to you, you don't have. Right? Both of those. Boxes it in both ways. He went on to say any federal official attempting to impose them should be arrested on the spot and prosecuted under Florida law. So I said, these guys who are pulling this, they also, do you notice, that they waited until they let their extended and extended and extended again unemployment benefits expire? As soon as the unemployment benefits, as soon as they cut the tap off on those things, then they started pushing out the mandates for all the companies to say, well, now you take it or you lose your job. And, oh, guess what? We've cut off the tack for the unemployment stuff. Leanna Wynn yesterday, I tell you what, she's still out there pushing all of this tyranny. Finally, Reason Magazine, Ronald Bailey, who is a big cheerleader of vaccines, and he just thinks that the FDA didn't go fast enough with warp speed. And now he says, Biden rolls out an industrial policy plan to overcome government-created COVID-19 testing shortages. But he's skeptical that they're going to be able to do this. See, the government can't do anything. They're vulnerable. And if we were to refuse to comply with this, that would be a very, very effective means. Just to say, hey, you guys can't even manufacture these bogus tests. So we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to look at 9/11. The aftermath of this, what is happening today in terms of commemoration. And we're going to go back a little bit in history and take a look at what actually happened on that day. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. TheDavidKnightShow.com.
Hear news now at APSRadioNews.com or get the APS Radio app and never miss another story.
Let's take a look at what has happened to our country after 20 years of 9/11, post-9/11. We had Department of Homeland Security created, but we also had the Defense Department. Both of them saw huge funding increases as Washington geared up to fight two conventional wars and to turn the entire world into a surveillance state. The U.S. had been cutting military spending, going back to 2001. Remember this? Remember the talk about the peace dividend? Remember how the Soviet Union had was on the ropes, financially busted? 1989, the wall came down. And here we were, just 12 years after the wall had come down and the Soviet Union were no longer a credible enemy. They needed a justification for this. Couldn't you get those big bucks for the long-range bombers from the military-industrial complex or more nuclear weapons, right? The big intercontinental multiple warhead missiles, the big-ticket items. Boy, we're going to have to come up with something else. And they were very clever about that. Instead of having one enemy, which could kind of collapse out of its own authoritarianism and bankruptcy as a corrupt and evil empire. Instead of that, how about this? We go to war against a tactic. That'll never end. That tactic could be anybody. It could be bin Laden. It could be some men in caves in Afghanistan. It could be some people in Iraq. It could be some people, out in the suburbs of America that are white Christians and conservatives. It could be anybody. You know, we're now the domestic terrorists. They've now focused that to us. And, of course, from the very beginning, because it was about terror, terror could be anywhere. Terror could be among us. We had to have the authorization for the use of military force worldwide. No more declarations of war. We have to respond quickly. We may have to torture people. We had 24 with Kiefer Sutherland telling us how essential it was when that time bomb is clicking, that we'd be allowed to torture people. All of these things have been used to completely alter our world, as you all know. But just think about the fact that back in 2001, the U.S. had been cutting military spending for a decade. The military spending as a share of gross domestic product had shrunk to less than a third the size that it was at the height of the Vietnam War, and less than half of what it had been during the Reagan years. Something must be done. Come on, guys, we're losing the justification for this war machine. Well, again, it can pivot to a tactic. It can be anywhere, everywhere. It can be in foreign countries. It can be domestic. It will never end. And that's about the time they started creating geospatial intelligence. As a matter of fact, it was not a reaction. None of this was a reaction. When you look at the foundation of the surveillance state, geospatial intelligence, they started ramping that up in the late 90s. They started creating the venture capital firms that would create the masters of the universe, as Breitbart calls them, the Silicon Valley surveillance complex. Facebook and the rest of these people, they started ramping that up a couple of years before this happened, amazingly enough. So we now have a new counterterrorism environment. To give you an example here, some dollars and cents, in 2001, the Defense Department had a $181 billion contract obligations to 46,000 contractors. 10 years later, that had doubled from $181 billion to $375 billion. They had gone from 46,000 contractors to 110,000 different companies. Some of the companies, for example, this particular one, CACI International Incorporated, they were a medium-sized government contractor on the eve of September 11th. They only had about $230 million in federal contracts. Today, they're nearly a $6 billion company with $3 billion in federal contracts. So the biggest rise, of course, was in the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, something that it's very rare for me to even mention. This is being mentioned by the Wall Street Journal, maybe the first time I've seen them use that term, Geospatial Intelligence Agency. The fastest growing part of the intelligence, the booming intelligence business, was geospatial intelligence. And Robert Cardillo, who was became a director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. That's really where James Clapper hung out primarily and where he rose in his career. But Robert Cardillo said, you can imagine what my task was in 1983. We stared at one country, but there was a massive expansion in intelligence data analysis programs after 9/11. He said, you go to post 9/11, you're not looking at just one country. No. You want us to track people? How about this? Small groups who work out of apartments in Germany or camps in the Afghanistan mountains. You can imagine the sea change that had to happen across the board to be able to spy to that level of detail on each and every one of us. And this is the basis, folks, for how they're applying what is going to become the social credit system that you've seen already in operation in China. What they're bringing in, elements of it, in terms of vaccine passports and other things, contact tracing. All of this goes back to that. It was all part of all of this was part of the plan. Part of it involved collecting huge troves of data on U.S. citizens when they pushed the Patriot Act. to compare their names against newly created watch lists and no-fly lists. And in secret, U.S. intelligence authorities were expanded to obtain access to communication records of Americans and the power to wiretap their calls without warrants. One big trend was a shift away from targeted surveillance of specific individuals toward bulk surveillance aimed at gleaning information from population-wide data. Now, the Wall Street Journal does not talk about the implications of that. Let me tell you what the implications of that are. If you want to psychologically manipulate a population, as we've seen happen in abundance over the last year, as said many times, you look at World War I, and the big issue there was Edward Bernays using marketing and psychological tactics to lie us into World War I. After that, he went into the private sector at Wall Street, the advertising firms, and not Wall Street, but Madison Avenue. And he took his expertise at manipulating massive segments of society and applied it commercially, Madison Avenue and the advertising agencies. In between those two, you had the Germans take his work and expand on it, Goebbels and others. And what you saw was an evolution going from what was newspaper at the time to broadcast media of radio and television. And we go back and we look at that propaganda. It seems very heavy-handed, very obvious what they're doing, because they've gotten much better at it. It's much more subtle. The advertising is more subtle. The government propaganda is more subtle. But then with what they were able to do with computers, because when you're talking about newspapers and you're talking about radio and you're talking about television, as they added those new capabilities, they were able to make it more visceral with the audio. They were able to make it even more visceral by adding audio and video with television. But it was still an open-loop system. In an open-loop system, it's hard to measure exactly what kind of effect you're having. So they worked a lot on polling. They did a lot of polling about things, but it was still not quite there. What the Internet allows them to do, especially social media, it allows them to do bulk surveillance that we're just talking about right here. They can put out the propaganda, and then they can look at your reaction to it. You want to think that they're looking at the reaction of people to what Biden said yesterday about the vaccine mandate? So you bet they are. And so they can close the loop on this, and they can get very, very accurate information, far more accurate, much larger base of information than they could with polling. And they can get it very quickly. They can scrape all this information off of social media without a search warrant. And so they can understand just how effective their messaging is. They can fine-tune their messaging. And that's why we're in the situation that we're in right now. And it also allows them to purge anybody who is opposing their messaging. Americans are warier of U.S. government surveillance, says a poll done by AP. It said only about a third of Americans believe the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were worth fighting, according to a new poll. More Americans also regard the threat from domestic terrorism as more worrisome than that of extremism abroad. Why is that? Because that's been the government propaganda message. That's been the message from mainstream media and propaganda. We now have a new thing, domestic terrorism. It began with the insurrection on January the 6th. A couple of people fighting their way into a building without any weapons. And so because of that, we have a new wave of domestic terrorism. And that is our threat. It is spreading like a cancer. Just like the unvaccinated are spreading illness like a cancer. People that have different political opinions than the administration are spreading insurrection like a cancer. In particular, 46% of Americans say they oppose the U.S. government responding to threats against a nation by reading emails sent between people outside of the U.S. without a warrant. That's compared to just 27% who are in favor. In a marked turnaround for the first years after September 11th, when Americans were more likely to tolerate the government's monitoring of communications in the name of defending the homeland, just call it the fatherland. Unbelievable. I always hated that, homeland. It's such an obvious Nazi reference to the fatherland, right? The poll found bipartisan concerns about the scope of surveillance and the expansive intelligence collection tools that U.S. authorities have at their disposal. They talked then to a couple of individuals that they say are indicative of the attitudes. And, of course, remember, this is AP, so they're going to pick and choose who they want to talk to. But one person they talked to says, well, who's going to get to decide? I'm a little bit wary of this, he says. Who's going to decide just how far you go to keep the country safe? It's always a question. Who watches the watchers? That was once asked about the people who watch over and guard us, but now it's literally the people who are watching us. Who watches the people who watch us? Oh, nobody. Nobody. Another person they talked to, another Democrat. Well, I wasn't for all that torture stuff, which is why they did it outside the country. I wasn't for that. But as far as the surveillance is concerned, you got to watch them, or else we're going to die. This is the same attitude. You got to get those unvaccinated people. Got to lock them up. We can't have them just roaming around. We're hearing this day after day from one politician after another. It doesn't matter what country it's in, whether it's Australia, whether it's Biden, whether it's Canada, whether it's France, whether it's the UK. All of these politicians are saying the same thing. They're reading off the same script. It's like, do you remember when we've had in the past, you'd see Sinclair Broadcasting, and this is your local news, and they've got a script. And, you know, they show a pair who are going back and forth, you know, reading the two-part script. And then they jump to another local station, and without skipping a beat, they say the same thing. And then they pull back and they show a wall of TV monitors with all these people in unison saying the same thing. That was Sinclair Broadcasting. But now what we're doing is we're seeing exactly the same thing being done by all these global leaders. And it doesn't matter what the local market is. It doesn't matter which country it is. It doesn't matter what political labels they're using, because they're just labels. They can call themselves socialist or conservative. They can call themselves liberal or libertarian. It doesn't matter. All of them are saying the same thing. It's like you watch these global leaders. We got people in Australia, public health officials, one after the other, talking about how it's a new world order, new world order, new world order. They're ordering you into a new world. And it's time we stop taking these orders. It's a long-term plan. And all of them are reading the same script. They said about half of the people they polled are opposed to government monitoring of internet searches. About a quarter of them are in favor. The other people are undecided. That does not look good, does it? Last year, when the Senate came one vote short of approving a proposal to prevent federal law enforcement from obtaining internet browsing information or search history without seeking a warrant. And the Democrats pulled from the House floor legislation to extend certain surveillance authorities when the Republicans turned against it. The Republicans are better on this than the Democrats are, but nobody respects the Constitution. Americans are more concerned about U.S.-based extremists, says AP News, telling us this. This is what you were concerned with. Says AP. So, Americans, this is called, when they do this in a poll, it's called push polling. When they take a poll and then they tell you what you're concerned about, that's a kind of push polling as well. That's used to push public opinion in a particular way. Because you want to be with the vast majority of people, don't you? You don't want to be some kind of a fringe kook, some kind of a conspiracy theorist outlier. So they say Americans are more concerned about U.S.-based extremists than they are about the international groups. And we know this because FBI Director Chris Wray said that. He has said that domestic terrorism on display during the January the 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol is, quote, metastasizing. See, it's a cancer. It's an insurrection, and it's metastasizing. Majorities of Republicans and Democrats believe that the spread of misinformation is an extremely or very concerning threat to the U.S., though Democrats are slightly more so. Yes. So on 9/11 attacks, 20th anniversary of the war on terror is not over, says the Miami Herald, because it will never be over. It will never be over because by design they went to war against a tactic. And this is going to metastasize, as you just point out, to any enemy, foreign or domestic. And domestic, it can be anybody that they point the finger at is now a terrorist. That's why I said, you want to know what the definition of terrorism is? It's using fear, it's using violence to achieve a social or political means. I'm telling you that the Trump and Biden administrations are terrorists. They're using the fear of the virus and the pandemic. They are using, in many countries and in some instances, they're using force, law enforcement. They're using force to enact this. They're terrorizing us into their new medical dictatorships. So for 20 years, we've had strict scrutiny by the TSA of all flyers. Nobody can come into the country without a vaccine. But now, think about this. For 20 years, look at all of the things that they've done at the airport with the TSA. And look at the fact that even though we haven't had any issues at all, I mean, we had the phony underwear bomber and the shoe bomber and stuff like that, nonsense like that. And those were set up. Those were false flag. Kurt Haskell pointed out, I said, yeah, this guy in a suit had some guy who looked like he was on drugs or out of it or something, and he, you know, comes up to the side, and Kurt Haskell was a lawyer. So he starts looking at this, and he said it was really suspicious. Goes up to the flight attendant, gets this guy on the plane. He said, I was watching that guy, and he was the one who tried to blow his underwear up, right? So now we've all got to go through body scanners and so forth. They just happen to have all the body scanners already built and manufactured and waiting in the warehouses to roll them out immediately that Christmas. And the guy who was who had manufactured them was Chertoff, who had been the first director of Homeland Security, who is now collecting his big reward. But we haven't had any terror attacks. I've talked over and over again as we've had other individuals who have filed suit over these body scanners. As part of the suit, they did discovery. As part of the discovery, documents were produced. They were supposed to be redacted and uploaded to pacer.gov, the government website. Instead, what they did was they uploaded the unredacted by mistake, and they were up there for about a day. We got to see what they didn't want us to see because that was very convenient. First, they show you the unredacted documents, and then they show you the redacted documents so you can see what they didn't want you to see. And what we saw was that as they were rolling out these body scanners and pat-down things, and you had here in Texas, you had David Simpson of Longview, Texas, an honest guy if I ever was one in politics. That's David Simpson. And I've interviewed him multiple times. Great guy. He got all of the Texas House to unanimously say, we're not going to do those body scanners and pat-downs of kids and stuff. And then you had the lieutenant governor, who was a retired CIA guy, who was, after he got out of the CIA, they set him up in the oil business, Dewhurst. And he spent more money to become lieutenant governor than anybody ever spent in the history of Texas for that office. Dewhurst, that CIA shill, wants a CIA, always a CIA. He led an opposition in the Senate, and they shut that down. As that was happening, part of this lawsuit where they put the stuff up and we could see what they didn't want us to see was at that exact time, 2011, the TSA said there is no threat to airplanes or to airports. And yet what have they done? They've continually ramped up the process. The same thing they're doing with all this pandemic. Even though the threat's not there, they continue to ramp it up. And so for 20 years, they've continued to ramp up this transportation security theater. Theater, that's what it is. And or training. It's really training. They've continued to ramp it up, and yet now, here we are, at the 20-year anniversary of Afghanistan, as it all collapses and they lose the war, they're bringing back people. You know, we were looking for Afghans. You know, we had all the jokes. They just arrested Granny. They accused her of knitting an Afghan on the plane. Right? It was always about the Afghans. And now they're bringing them in by the tens of thousands. Unvetted. They don't know who these people are. Untested. For the pandemic. I mean, just look at that. And leaving Americans behind at the same time. When you look at that, you realize what a sham this whole thing is. You realize what a sham this war on terror was, what a sham the war in Afghanistan was, what a sham this pandemic war against each and every one of us is here in America. You got Mike McCall, reliable warmonger, says, well, Afghanistan's now worse than it was before 9/11 because now they got our weapons. So we might have to go back there. Okay, yeah, right. Yeah. And, you know, they've got our weapons. Well, I think the police departments have got more weapons. It was James Madison who said, in the debates about the Federal Convention, 1787, the means of defense against foreign danger have always been instruments of tyranny at home. Among the Romans, it was a standing maxim to excite a war whenever a revolt was apprehended. So they are exciting a war against the unvaccinated, but they have brought these weapons home that were abroad. Over the last decade or so, we've seen a massive militarization of domestic police forces. Federal grants brought the equipment of war on terror home to American police departments, writes Reason Magazine. In 2003, the rising Department of Homeland Security began issuing millions of dollars to cities and regions for counterterrorism equipment and training. They have now, we see them spending it on things like automated license plate readers, drones, facial recognition technology, tactical body armor, and giant armored vehicles. Because, you know, we have landmines all over America being used by terrorists. You know, the only violent people we've seen, really, are the BLM and Antifa. But, of course, they didn't consider that to be an insurrection. They freaked out when President Trump says an insurrection. They said, what are you going to do, create martial law? And now all you hear from the left is insurrection, insurrection, insurrection. Technology and equipment migrated from the various fronts in the war to on terror to small-town police departments back in the homeland. The grants were supposed to fund counterterrorism, but they were used for general crime fighting. They were used against the population. That's all it is. Secrecy made it hard for the public and the media to discover the scope or the privacy implications, or even the effectiveness of the new police gear. Just like we can't determine the effectiveness of the vaccine. We can't, you know, they hide information about everything they do. Executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation said this age of governmental secrecy comes hand in hand with a reduction of our privacy. And that is a lethal combination. As I've said many times, they continually demand to know everything about us while they hide everything, even the most trivial things, from us. It is a lethal combination. Today, police departments across the country are using more than $1 billion in surplus military equipment handed out since 9/11. A study released last year by Brown University on the Cost of War Project found that the Department of Defense's 1033 program, that's the one where they were putting out the MRAPs and stuff, right? Which offers free surplus military equipment to police departments, has transferred at least $1.6 billion worth of equipment to police departments since 9/11, compared to just $27 million before the attack. In other words, they ramped it up by 64 times. And then that's nothing compared to what the Department of Homeland Security gives out. The Department of Homeland Security doesn't give out $1.6 billion. They give out $24.3 billion. So when you look at this, all together, they have ramped up the amount of money that was going to police departments of surplus military equipment by a factor of over 1,000. Over 1,000 times more money given to police departments than prior to 9/11. Went from $27 million to $25 billion, a little over $25 billion. And at the same time, it was back in 2014, 2015, I can't remember exactly, but at some point in time, after World War II, it had been very common for the U.S. military, as they had older equipment, decommissioned equipment, surplus equipment, that they would give it to rural firefighting companies because it was always the case. This is not something that just started with so-called climate change and so forth. No, it was, they would, you would be more likely to have a forest fire naturally occurring in big rural areas. And so the people who would be there on the front lines to try to fight it would be rural fire departments that didn't have a lot of money. In many cases, they were volunteer. And so the U.S. government at the time, it was trying to make things better in this country instead of trying to destroy this country, would give them surplus equipment to fight the fires. And as Obama was on this manic mission to give all kinds of military equipment to police forces, even small ones, they stopped giving any equipment at all to the fire departments. And that lasted for a couple of months. These volunteer fire departments were very vocal, and they got several senators to push back on it. They restarted that program to some degree, but it is very, very small still compared to what they do for the police department. See, they see you as the fire that has to be put out. City Council in Vallejo, California, for example, recently agreed to expand its network of automated license plate readers after it got $30,000 from the Urban Areas Security Initiative. In 2012, the late Senator Tom Coburn, Republican, Oklahoma, released a report detailing how local police departments are, quote, arming themselves with military assets more often reserved for war zones. And we see other things like Stingray or cell phone simulators. They spoof a cell tower so that they can track people without a search warrant. All of these things, the way that this government has turned on its own people and set up a worldwide system of surveillance, that was all justified, quote unquote, by 9/11. And now we see that DHS, Alejandro Mayorkas, the head of Homeland Security, is now saying white Americans are supporting the Taliban and white Americans are poised to carry out terror attacks. And we see that Michael Hayden, former head of the NSA, former head of the CIA, as all this stuff was ramping up, is calling white Americans and conservatives our Taliban. They continue to make comparisons of us to what they initiated this stuff 20 years ago. And 20 years ago, I was among the people who were saying they're not doing this to fight terrorism. They're ramping this up to fight Americans. All the same tactics our globalist overlords use to smear all Muslims as terrorists in order to launch the war on terror in the Middle East, writes Information Liberation, are now being used against American people to launch a new domestic war on terror here at home. Every day, without pause, the ADL, CNN, the propagandists there, as well as Homeland Security and the Biden administration, every day without pause, they're using the ADL's own inflated numbers, showing that 2020 had the lowest number of domestic extremist-related killings in over a decade. There is so little domestic terrorism from white extremists, so-called, that the FBI has had to manufacture fake terror plots. They've had to fund satanic neo-Nazi terrorist death cults in a desperate bid to create the false perception that that is America's greatest threat. It probably won't be long before they deem it necessary to stage another 9/11 to justify stripping us of all of our rights once and for all while they loot the nation and bleed us dry. Well, I agree, but don't forget that what happened yesterday was the other shoe to drop. That was part of 9/11. 2 months before 9/11, they did the first one of these simulations, Dark Winter. They've done them on an annual basis. It was done by Johns Hopkins. It was done by the CDC and all the usual suspects. Playing out this exact scenario, training people who were going to be implementing it, wargaming it, fine-tuning the propaganda with it, telling everybody you're going to lock everyone down. Everybody died because you weren't draconian enough. Everybody died because you didn't approve an emergency vaccine and force everybody to take it. This has always been the plan, and they've been rehearsing this plan for 20 years. So the first one was 2 months before 9/11. The week after 9/11, they had the anthrax attacks. Very suspicious. We'll talk more with the people from the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 inquiry coming up in the third hour. And then, so that happened a week after 9/11. And then 2 months later, they pushed out the Model State Health Emergency Powers Act to the states. This is a legislation that we would like you to enact. And much of it was enacted. And then it was activated last year with the National State of Emergency Executive Order that President Trump did, along with massive amounts of money to incentivize the governors to do that. White supremacists and anti-government extremists have expressed admiration for what the Taliban accomplished. And this is what is being told to us by CNN. See, these are the lies that they tell you. This is a pandemic, and it's the unvaccinated who are doing this to us, and it's domestic extremists who are conservative and anti-government that are doing this to us. They're the threat to us. White supremacists and other domestic, still quoting from CNN, white supremacists and other domestic violent extremist groups frame the activities of the Taliban as a success. Well, we did lose a war. And I've been reporting on asymmetric warfare for a long time. I went to one of the asymmetric warfare training centers and everything. But I listened as part of that to these, you find on YouTube, at least at that time, you find all these discussions by military bureaucrats and generals and so forth saying, you know, we're not winning these asymmetric wars. And they identified the enemy. They said, you know, they're not really religiously motivated. Religion comes into it at the end of it. They said a typical terrorist is somebody who is in their 30s. They were a professional engineer or a doctor. They were somebody who was highly educated and successful. But they view their future as having been cut off. They have been occupied and oppressed, and they see themselves as having no future. At that point, they turn to religion, and then they get violent. Now these people are saying this about us here in America. That's one of the reasons why, as Doug Wilson said, we must not take the bait. You have to remember that Christians, when we use the term martyr for Christian, is very different from the Islamic religion. The term martyr was a Greek word for witness. These are people who were killed by the Romans because they refused to deny what they had seen and what they knew was true. You know, it was too important. And that is one of the key evidences. As a matter of fact, you know, we look at the death of the martyrs, and I can't remember the guy's name. It was a guy who was a cold case detective. He would go back and he would open up cases that were unsolved. And all the people who had been initial witnesses were dead. And he would go back and try to solve the case again. And so he would be looking at testimony of people who had long since died. He couldn't evaluate them again. And he would use certain things to do that. As an atheist, his wife became a Christian, and he was not happy about that. And he was going to disprove the Bible to her. And so he starts with this investigation. And he started using the same tactics that he used to look at cold cases. His book is Cold Case Christianity. I can't remember his name. But what he said was, you know, when you look at this, when somebody makes a deathbed confession, or when they're willing to die over something that they've seen and say that they've seen rather than recant it, you know, that makes that very, very credible. And so, you know, we look at the situation and we look at the suffering that happened to people who were who were executed in horrific ways by the Romans. What that did was that testified to the reality of what they had seen. Now, the difference is that the Muslims, when they say martyr, they mean somebody who's going to go blow somebody up and kill themselves at the same time. And they believe that because they have a system that is based on works. And so if you kill the infidel, then that's a good work, and that's going to get you to heaven, right? We, on the other hand, have a different system. That we've all sinned and fallen short, and there's only one way that we're going to ever be able to accomplish that, and that's based on what Christ has done for us. So we have to understand that we are not Muslims, and that even though people turn to religion in times of stress, Our religion does not turn us into suicide bombers, in spite of what Christopher Wray, Michael Hayden, James Clapper, CNN, and the rest of these lying, thieving terrorists say. They are the murderers. We have to understand that. We have to transcend them. I'm not saying that we don't defend ourselves if somebody comes after us, but that's not on the table right now. And you better make it very clear that it is self-defense. Because if you defend yourself in a situation where people don't see it, then they're going to make you out to be the aggressor. And then they'll use that just like they used January the 6th, so a small number of people got violent. That is the difference, you know. And we also understand that our war is within, right? Kingdom of God is within you, and your war is within you. You are fighting against yourself to mortify that sin that still remains in you. Whereas in these other religions that are based on works, it's easy for them then to project them onto other people and to say that their war is a peer-to-peer war. But going back to the politics here, the only person killed on January the 6th, as Information Liberation points out, of course, was a 14-year Air Force veteran, Ashley Babbitt, killed by Capitol Police Officer Michael Byrd, despite posing no threat and having no weapons. DHS has been hyping the white extremist threat with new bulletins every few weeks, and literally nothing has happened, and they are really frustrated about it. You know, we've had, by the way, over the 20 years of the war, according to an article on Zero Hedge, commondreams.org, U.S. airstrikes have killed up to 48,000 civilians since 9/11. Brown University's Cost of Wars project estimates that over 387,000 civilians have been killed as a result of the war on terror. Air Wars sought to answer a specific question. How many civilians have likely been killed by U.S. airstrikes in the last 20 years? The answer, said Air Wars is an organization. Air Wars found at least 22,679, potentially as many as 48,308 civilians. Civilians. It was not just combatants. And again, it makes it difficult to understand who the civilians are in an Islamic country because they do not follow the rules that were set up in Western civilization based on Christianity trying to have the just war scenario, have people be clearly marked as combatants wearing uniforms. They don't do that. The Pentagon has declared a minimum of 91,340 airstrikes in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Seven countries that the U.S. military invaded or assaulted with bombs or drones. You know, we look at this and go back and look at the Muslim ban that they were all so freaked out about. And I said, well, you know, there are seven countries on that. Two of them were not even Muslim. The other are other five were predominantly Muslim, but there's 50 predominantly Muslim countries. That means that only 10% of the Muslim countries had a ban on them. It wasn't a Muslim ban. But those were also countries that the Biden administration had gone to war with, had dropped bombs on, just as I pointed out here. Let's take a look, though, at the giant lie, the fundamental lie that was the basis for the domestic surveillance, the domestic war on terror, the Afghan war, the Iraq war, all these wars. What was it all based on? Let's go back and take a look at it. And, of course, we've got several people in the UK and other families who want to get to the bottom of this. Who was it that really did this? You know, we have a conspiracy theory that three buildings, steel skyscrapers, just collapsed in their footprint real quickly after some fires, and only two of them were even hit by a plane. And then we have some other conspiracy theories about this. And that's a conspiracy theory that is really not possible. And so you got a family of one of the British people who has died, 67 people from the UK died on that day. One of them, Jeff Campbell and his family, are now saying they've got 3,000 pages of evidence that the towers were blown up from the inside. And they want a hearing about this. I interviewed many years ago Tony Rook, and he had a court case. You know, you're required to pay a license to the BBC, and the famous incident of Building 7 which was not hit by a plane, but collapsed. And 20 minutes before it collapsed, you had a reporter with a building over the shoulder announcing that it had collapsed 20 minutes before it happened. And so he said, well, that means that the BBC had some foreknowledge. That meant that they were complicit in all of this. And I'm not going to pay a licensing fee to a terrorist organization. And they took him to court, and the judge agreed with him, which is basically saying, yeah, they did have foreknowledge, and they did lie about this, and they were complicit in this. And he also did a documentary called Incontrovertible, where he set up a jury, and he went through the whole bit of evidence. His father had been a police officer, and so he had a lot of police officers, former judges, and all these people who, they weren't just a random jury. These are people who were used to seeing evidence and arguing about, you know, in court cases, about murders and crimes, and he presented the evidence to them in that documentary. But getting back to this, in the family of Jeff Campbell, thousands of well-meaning people have worked tirelessly to uncover the details behind the events of 9/11, which set off decades of horrific wars, killed thousands of people, and are turning us in, have turned us into a police surveillance state. But the 67 citizens of the UK, Campbell's family, for the last several years, they've been working to expose evidence, which they say shows that the towers were blown up from the inside. His family, supported by teams of scientists who have been studying the collapse of the buildings, claim the towers were laced with explosives, which is what brought them down, not the airplanes. As a matter of fact, they say, I believe there's been a cover-up. We have scientifically, forensically backed evidence that the official narrative surrounding the Twin Towers collapse on 9/11 is wrong, said his older brother. I believe my brother and thousands of others were murdered on 9/11, and there has been a cover-up. We are still overcoming this tragedy, but we will never stop seeking the truth. According to architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, the Campbell family application includes letters of support from five other family members who lost loved ones. The application also includes witness statements from six scientific experts, from five eyewitnesses to the World Trade Center's destruction, four of whom were first responders that day. All the experts, we got experts here, experts and eyewitnesses have offered to give testimony at the new inquest. Altogether, the application contains about 2,500 pages of evidence, as well as select volumes of official reports issued by the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST. Now, when we look at a controlled demolition, and we look at a building that falls down, this is what we see when we see a controlled demolition. This is in the middle of a city. There are a lot of skyscrapers around. You don't want this thing just toppling over. It comes right down into its footprint. Isn't it convenient that that's what happened with the World Trade Towers? You know, if you have one of these things go wrong and it goes sideways, literally goes sideways when it falls, it takes out everything in its footprint. Can you imagine how much destruction there would have been if they hadn't conveniently just collapsed in their own footprint? And if you look at the pictures of 9/11 as these buildings are collapsing, it looks very much like a controlled demolition. Now, these are some clips that I've put together. Hear that? Boom, boom, boom. This is what the firefighters were saying they heard, Building 7. I was talking over it, but you could hear, if I wasn't talking, you could have heard them saying, pull it, and you hear, boom, 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 boom. Now, NIST says of Building 7, that was just because the floors were collapsing against each other. No, it is what you always hear when they do the controlled demolitions. That's not the floors collapsing one on top of another as it conveniently falls and free fall. 2.5 seconds for Building 7 to suddenly collapse into its own footprint, falling at free fall speed for 2.5 seconds
of its second. Here's a few more demolitions that didn't quite
complete
make the list.
Destruction. Here's one that doesn't quite make it. Goes a little bit sideways there, but not much. This is a science. They know how to do this. And we know what one looks like. And that's why President Trump, on the day of, said, well, I've seen a lot of building demolitions. That looked like a building demolition. That building is the strongest building I've seen. You know, Trump, because he had connections with the mafia. He was building, even after everybody else was building steel buildings, he was building concrete skyscrapers because the concrete contracts were owned by the mafia. And they were going to make sure that he didn't have any labor issues. But he said, yeah, that was strong. That was made out of steel. It had steel all around it. I mean, it's like a fortress. And he said, and that's a really strong building. They had that attacked at the foundation level, you know, back in the 90s, and it didn't fall down. That looks like a controlled demolition. But, of course, he never released the information. He never did an investigation about that. And his bestie, best friend forever, Rudy Giuliani, sent people to die to destroy the evidence. Sent people in without sufficient masks, of all things, so they could do a cover-up, so they could quickly take all of the stuff away and remove it to a foreign country. Ah, nothing to see here, right? Nothing suspicious about that. Last year, architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth announced the completed partnership with the University of Alaska Fairbanks and their final report of an in-depth 4-year study on what they say actually brought down the World Trade Center. I interviewed them when that happened. A couple of times I interviewed them. According to the press release, contrary to the conclusions of NIST, the Alaska Fairbanks University research team finds that the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7 on 9/11 was not caused by fires, but that it was instead caused by the near simultaneous failure of every column in the building. So it just doesn't, a building does just doesn't just fall down unless there is something that initiates that. And it doesn't all fall down simultaneously. And they proved that with their investigation. And we just recently had, here's another one going on, here the explosion's going off. I'll wait for this thing to fall and then we'll go to picture of what really happens when a building catches fire, especially if it's a steel skyscraper. Here goes a cooling tower for a nuclear reactor. Hey, you know, they work this out. You know, when they do this, they want to make sure they fall in their footprint again so they don't take out anything else. And that's what we saw very conveniently. Now, this is a picture coming out of Milan. This just happened about 2 weeks ago. This building burned for a long, long time, and we've seen this over and over and over again. Steel skyscraper, and you can see there it's got a steel structure, and there's concrete in between that steel structure. This thing burned for a very long time until there was nothing left other than the steel structure. Burned well into the night, and yet it didn't fall down. And I've shown pictures of buildings that have burned for days, steel skyscrapers. Sometimes they'll lean, they'll twist. They typically don't fall down at all, even after they are thoroughly burned. But, of course, Building 7 just fell on its own footprint. You had Silverstein, as they said pull it, which is what they do when they demolish a building. And it had not been hit by a plane. And the people who did the architects and engineers, as well as the university in Alaska, did simulations. They said fire did not cause a collapse of World Trade Center 7. It was not hit by a plane. Did not cause a collapse, contrary to the conclusions of NIST. Here's this building still burning well into the night, still up there, burned everything away, but did not collapse. They said the secondary conclusion of our study is that the collapse of World Trade Center 7 was a global failure involving the near simultaneous failure of every column in the building, which is what a demolition is designed to do. That's why you go do it yourself. Go on YouTube, look at building demolitions, and then go back and look at 9/11, every single one of them. Finally, after nearly two decades of ridicule, dismissal, outright intolerance of information contrary to the official story, the public may finally learn the whole truth of what happened and who was behind it. Let's hope so. But, you know, this raises an uncomfortable question. I mean, can you really believe that the U.S. government was capable of doing something like that? Morally capable? I mean, technology-wise, yes, of course. Of course they were. Whatever they did, whether it was internal explosions, whether it was something that some people were saying, well, I think it was a directed energy beam or something. Whatever. I don't know what it was. I know what did not happen. I know that three buildings did not collapse in their footprint like that in just a couple of hours after only two of them were even hit by a plane. So I know that did not happen. Now, we can talk about what else might have happened, but let me tell you what almost did happen. And if you don't think that your American government is capable of doing something like this, back in the 1960s, late 1960s, I think it is safe to say, couldn't we all agree that the American government had higher standards, higher morality, we had a better caliber of people there in the 1960s? This country was different. It was different World War II in the 1950s and the early 1960s, much different than today. And yet, in 1962, Operation Northwoods, a proposed top-secret plan stating the intent amongst the Joint Chiefs of Staff to stage terrorist attacks, including killing innocent civilians in order to provoke a war with Cuba. They were willing to kill Americans. This is your own Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon in 1962. What do you think they're capable of today? This woke satanic mob. And that isn't something that just happened now. It's been a downward spiral. It's been going for a long time. But I'm talking about back in 1962. This is a document that was declassified in 1997. So it remained classified for 35 years. It was declassified as they were doing investigations into the assassination of JFK. What did this have to do with the assassination of JFK, possibly? Well, what was it? Proposals included the use of drone aircraft. You mean drone aircraft back in 1962 could do something like this? Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I thought was very telling about all this was the public's naivete about the fact that, it couldn't be drones that were flown in for show into the building and then, you know, collapse it with explosives that were there. You know, they don't have that kind of capability. Well, for the longest time, they would deliberately crash commercial airliners that were being remotely flown so that they could get the pictures of what the crash looked like. You know, like you see them crashing cars into a wall, and you've got the crash dummies in there, and they've got the cameras inside of it. You see the slow-motion cameras from every angle. You can see what the damage is. Well, they do the same thing with commercial airline planes, except they don't have them being flown by people. You know, they're remotely controlled, and it isn't like it is with a car where you can put it on a rail and just, you know, shoot it into the, pull it along into the barrier. No, they flew those, and they flew them into the ground because, you know, they don't have to land them. That's the hard part. And that's what everybody was saying. Well, of course, those guys out of caves, of course they could fly that because they didn't have to land it. You know, they only had to crash it. And it's like, well, you know, they were doing that remote control for the longest time. And it was, you know, the American public, no, they couldn't fly drones for show into a building like that. And yet, right away, we saw they had not only drones, but they had a lot of them stockpiled as military weapons. And they were dropping bombs on people within a couple of months after all this stuff. And back in 1962, they proposed using drone aircraft to stage foreign attacks, including staging hijackings, staging attacks on U.S. vessels and facilities, staging riots, as well as staging terror campaigns on U.S. soil. The plan called for the CIA or for other operatives to commit genuine acts of terrorism in the United States, in cities, and elsewhere. These acts of terrorism were to be blamed on Cuba in order to create public support for war against that nation. The document was signed by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Lyman Limnitzer, reportedly presented to the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, March the 13th, 1962. The previously top-secret document was originally made public on November the 18th, 1997, by the JFK Assassination Records Review Board, a U.S. federal agency overseeing the release of government records relating to JFK's assassination. What they proposed to do, in the recommendations section, they said, quote, the, quote, justification for U.S. military intervention in Cuba memo, the Joint Chiefs made clear their willingness to stage actual terrorist events with legitimate casualties. killing Americans in order to get their war in Cuba. The use of drone aircraft to simulate air-related catastrophes. They said it is possible, quoting from the document, it is possible to create an incident which will demonstrate convincingly that Cuban aircraft was attacked and shot down, had attacked and shot down a chartered civilian airliner en route from the U.S. to Jamaica, Guatemala, Panama, Venezuela, someplace. The destination will be chosen only to cause the flight plan route to cross Cuba. The passengers could be a group of college students off on a holiday or any grouping of people with a common interest to support chartering a non-scheduled flight. An aircraft at Eglin Air Force Base would be painted. This is what they're proposing in the document. Painted and numbered as an exact duplicate for a civil registered aircraft belonging to a CIA proprietary organization in the Miami area. At a designated time, the duplicate would be substituted for the actual civil aircraft and would be loaded with the selected passengers, all boarded under carefully prepared aliases. The actual registered aircraft would be converted to a drone. Takeoff times of the drone aircraft and the actual aircraft will be scheduled to allow a rendezvous south of Florida. From the rendezvous point, the passenger-carrying aircraft will descend to a minimum altitude and go directly into an auxiliary field at Eglin Air Force Base, where arrangements will be made to evacuate the passengers and return the aircraft to its original status. The drone aircraft, meanwhile, will continue to fly the filed flight plan, and when over Cuba, the drone will begin transmitting on the international distress frequency a Mayday message, stating that he is under attack by Cuban MiG aircraft. The transmission will be interrupted by destruction of the aircraft, which will be triggered by radio signal. This will allow radio stations in the Western Hemisphere to tell the U.S. what has happened to the aircraft instead of the U.S. trying to sell the incident. This is the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1962, talking about how they were going to stage and switch out the passengers with a replica drone than make it look like the replica drone that looked like a civilian aircraft was shot down. Hijacking attempts, they said also, against civil air and surface craft should appear to continue as harassing measures cordoned by the government of Cuba. Condoned. We could develop a communist Cuban terror campaign in the Miami area, in other Florida cities, and even in Washington. The terror campaign could be pointed at refugees. They said you could sink a boat load of Cubans en route to Florida. This sinking could be real or it could be simulated. We don't really care. Right? Kill real people if you think it's more convincing, right? We could foster, they said, quote, foster attempts on lives of Cuban refugees in the U.S., even to the extent of wounding in instances to be widely publicized. Exploding a few plastic bombs in carefully chosen spots, or the arrest of Cuban agents and the release of prepared documents substantiating Cuban involvement also would be helpful in projecting the idea of an irresponsible government. We could do a Remember the Maine incident. We could blow up a U.S. ship in Guantanamo Bay and blame Cuba. We could blow up a drone anywhere in Cuban waters. We could arrange to cause an incident in the vicinity of Havana. We could stage fires and mortar attacks on U.S. military bases to cause actual damage and to installations and potentially even to U.S. military personnel. We don't care if we do friendly fire. So this document, Operation Northwoods, was given to McNamara, was given to JFK. And the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Lyman Limnitzer, was relieved of duty by JFK. He was transferred then to, in a demotion, to Europe. When he got to Europe, he oversaw Operation Gladio, which was another false flag event, which had operatives of NATO pretending that they were communist revolutionaries. And if you remember the Red Brigade, the murder of Aldo Moro and others, CIA, Kissinger, Pechenik, as the Italian government says, all involved in Operation Gladio. But it was Lyman Limnitzer, the guy who was going to do Operation Northwoods, which looks uncannily like what some people have suggested may have happened on 9/11. Are they morally capable of doing this? You bet. Are they morally capable of killing a president who stopped them from doing this? You bet. The fact that the Pentagon and the CIA hid the deeply cynical nature of Operation Northwoods from the public and from the JFK investigators for 35 years invites suspicion that the national security agencies had, and perhaps still have, something to hide. So the mentality of Kennedy's military advisors who pursued devious, murderous conspiracies to advance their ambition of launching a preemptive war against Cuba to remove Castro from power is the way James Douglas describes it. Northwoods, he said, is a prescription for treason. So what do we know about 9/11? Well, we do know that an airliner almost certainly did not hit the Pentagon. Hard physical evidence supports this conclusion. Think about the fact that you've not seen any pictures of that flying into that building. Pentagon is one of the most highly surveilled buildings anywhere. They have cameras everywhere. Why don't they have a picture of the plane flying into the building? Why did the FBI go around and confiscate all surveillance footage from neighboring businesses at the same time? Hard physical evidence also supports the conclusion because of the size of the hole, much smaller than an airline would create. The building was thus presumably hit by something smaller, perhaps a missile, perhaps a drone, or less possibly a small manned aircraft. Absolutely no information is available on what happened to the original aircraft, the crew, the hijackers, the passengers. The official stories that appears in the 9/11 Commission report simply says at 9:37, American Airlines Flight 77 crashed into the Pentagon, traveling at approximately 530 miles per hour. All on board, as well as many civilians and military personnel in the building, were killed. This allows readers to assume that pieces of the aircraft and some bodies of the passengers were found in the rubble of the crash. But information so far released from the government does not show that such evidence was in fact found. We did see pictures after the fact of a piece of a tail that was there. But engines were not there. The kind of stuff that you would expect were not there. Bodies were not there. They all just vaporized, just like the bodies all disappeared at United Flight number, was it 93? I'm just going from memory here. They all disappeared as well. Story put out by the Pentagon is the plane and its passengers were just incinerated. Yet, video footage of offices in the Pentagon, situated at the edge of the hole, clearly show that the office furniture was undamaged. So all the bodies were just completely incinerated, and yet you've seen the pictures of the furniture sitting right there. Didn't incinerate the furniture. The size of the hole in the Pentagon wall still remains as valid evidence and is irrefutable. Irrefutable. As a matter of fact, I was stunned. It was about 6 or 7 years ago, my wife and I went to Wimberley, and we were just taking a drive. And it's a little kind of a touristy type of place or whatever, a lot of little shops. And so we got out to stretch our legs, and we're walking through the shops, and there was a lady there. And it was like a kind of a Christmas, mainly Christmas shop with knickknacks and things like that. And we walked in. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm retired military, and my husband and I make this. And she's talking. And Karen is walking around looking at the place, and I'm standing there, you know, looking at my phone and just kind of, you know, put it away, and I'm listening to this lady. She wants to tell me about how, you know, she used to be in the military, and she did this and that, and then, you know, the two of them retired, and they set up this store, and they make all this stuff and everything. And then she started to get into her military career. First, she started telling me about how they make all this stuff, and then she started getting into her military career. And she said, yeah, I used to be a part of the office that did audits. And she says, I'm really lucky. I just got out a couple of months before 9/11. And it landed. Can you believe it? I mean, what luck. I was no longer that landed right there in the office where I worked. I was like, whoa. I take out my phone and start recording. But I wanted to hear what she had to say more than anything. So I figured she'd shut up if I told her. And so I'm asking her questions. But she's just monologuing about all this stuff. And she said, we had uncovered trillions of dollars in fraud. She said there were major people who were politicians who were retiring because they were given that option rather than going to jail. Right, just resign now. And people in the military. She said it was amazing what we had. And we were right in the middle of that, and I was really upset that I had to stop. But my husband had a health issue, and he had to get out, and so I decided that I would go ahead and get out as well. And it's lucky I did, because just a couple of months later, this plane just happened to land right there in that office. And it's like, she couldn't put any of this stuff together. I'm asking her, where do you get your news? How do you, you know, do... She listens to CNN, Fox News, and stuff. She doesn't. She had absolutely no clue. So, yeah, that's my 9/11 story. And I've thought about it many times. I thought, boy, I wish I had taken out the... But she was kind of doing it on the side, and I really thought she was going to clam up, and I was more interested in hearing what she had to say. And, of course, you know, you can believe me or not believe me, because, you know, the government's got an official story, and anything that contradicts that, just obviously bunk. I'm just making all this stuff up, right? That's what you can say. No, I heard her say it. The North and South Towers of the World Trade Center almost certainly did not collapse and fall to Earth because they were hit by hijacked aircraft. A plane did not even hit Building 7, which also collapsed. And all three were most probably destroyed by controlled demolition charges. Now, this is somebody's opinion that was written at the time. This is about 5 years after the event. This was written as a summary. But now we've had the simulations, detailed simulations of that. And for at least an hour and 45 minutes after the hijacking, the first aircraft... after the first aircraft was known to divert from its flight path, U.S. air defense authorities failed to take meaningful action. This strikes some as valid evidence that the U.S. Air Force was deliberately restrained from acting. Now, this individual says, well, maybe so, but my own skepticism tells me that the inefficiency of U.S. defense forces is likely to be just as plausible an explanation. Gore Vidal has a different idea about this, as a matter of fact. And I'll get to that in a moment, because Gore Vidal, and I forget whether it was his father or his uncle, was instrumental in setting up NORAD. He knew what it was about. And so he didn't buy that at all. But anyway, getting on with some of the other issues, major issues with this. And let me say, before I get away from the Pentagon any further, you know, interestingly enough, you had Ken Olson, who had presided over the election, adjudicated the 2000 election, you know, where they're talking about the hanging chads and all that sort of thing, and then got a high position, was put in a high position in the Bush administration. We were told that he was on the phone with his wife, who was on the plane that flew into the Pentagon, and many other things. And, you know, we were told, and she was just calling on a cell phone, right? And so for years and years, I would do that. I would turn on my cell phone, see if I could make a call to somebody. Never got through. You take the plane off the ground, and it's going through those cell phone towers so quickly it doesn't work. You know, you have special phones that are on the airplanes themselves. But all this nonsense about people calling on cell phones? Not possible. Certainly not in 2001. Not at all possible. Now, I don't know what happened to Ken Olson and his wife, but she's sleeping with the fishes, I guess. None of the 19 hijackers' bodies were ever autopsied, since they were allegedly totally destroyed in the crashes, just like the people in Pennsylvania. Numerous pilots have allegedly said that none of the 19 hijackers could have flown the airliners well enough to hit the World Trade Center towers and the Pentagon with as much accuracy as was displayed. They say even more than that. Pilots for 9/11 Truth say, no, you can't fly those planes at that speed and at that altitude. I know, because I've flown them for many years. One of them, one of the pilots for 9/11 Truth, was a flight instructor, and he says, I know you cannot fly those planes at that low an altitude where the air is thicker at that speed. Machinations in the U.S. stock market in the days before 9/11 suggest that some inside players in the market knew or suspected that this would happen. Absolutely. Paul Joseph Valvano, back in 2015, when he was talking about the involvement of the Bush family in this. Here's what he had to say about the Bush family's footprints. He said they're all over the security provided for the Twin Towers right up until the events of 9/11. The company, Securicom, was in charge of the quote-unquote security of the Twin Towers from before the very first attack on the Twin Towers in 1993 until after the attacks on 9/11. President George Bush's brother, Marvin, was a principal administrative employee with SecureCom until 1999. So he was there when the 1993 bombing of the foundation occurred, the basement. Then when he left in 1999, President Bush's cousin, Wirt Walker III, was the CEO of SecureCom from 1999 until after the attacks on 9/11. Keeping in mind that there is evidence that the Bush group had been considering military action in the Mideast before George Bush was elected to the presidency, he said it would seem that the security for the Twin Towers may have been compromised and could have easily been done if the Bush family was a part of this. Both brother Marvin and cousin Wirt. No wonder President Bush, whose father, President George H.W. Bush, had taken the nation to war in Panama in 1989 and the Persian Gulf in 1990, who had also been a director of the CIA in 1996. He was handpicked to rebuild the CIA after the damage that was done by the Church Committee hearing. Oh, by the way, his right-hand man, William Barr. He was handpicked the chairman of the 9/11 Commission in the same way that President Lyndon Johnson handpicked the chairman of the Warren Commission. So George W. Bush picks the chairman just like LBJ picks the chairman of the JFK Commission. No wonder that all the debris from the Twin Towers was rushed out of this country as soon as possible so that no real examination of the debris could take place. This could be likened to killing Lee Harvey Oswald and burying him within days of the murder of JFK. I'll just throw this in as a little additional bonus here for the Bush family. 2015. Whatever happened to Marvin Bush after his role in the 9/11 Twin Tower security? Better yet, what happened to his babysitter? In this article, they got a picture of whatever happened to Baby Jane and Betty Davis and, the crazy woman in that movie. Anyway, 62-year-old Bertha Champagne, described as a longtime babysitter for Marvin and Margaret Bush's two children, son Walker, 13, daughter Marshall, 17, was found crushed to death by her own vehicle in a driveway in front of the Bush family home. The story goes that Bertha Champagne had left the residence to retrieve something from her car, which police say had somehow been left in gear. According to the police report, the car rolled forward and pinned the woman between it and a small building next to the driveway, possibly a checkpoint built by the Secret Service when George H.W. Bush was president. Then the car mysteriously, this is 2015, then the car mysteriously rolled on to cross a small street in front of the Bush compound, then crossed a busy two-lane street, finally coming to rest in a wooded area across the street that adjoins the prestigious Belhaven Country Club. No explanations were given as to why the vehicle did not move until she was in front of it in a position to be crushed. No explanation was given as to what she was retrieving or why she seemed to be in front of the car. While it was simply rolling with a mind of its own, you know, like the Stephen King car, Christine. I mean, you know, what? This thing crushes her against the wall and then somehow changes direction and continues to roll on. Did it take the building down? I don't know. But, you know, there's, just as we see with the Clintons, there's a lot of very strange happenings to people that are affiliated with them. Same thing happens to the Bush crime family, doesn't it? Now, I said before that Gore Vidal was very suspicious about the NORAD situation because he had, again, it was his father or his uncle who were, the architect of this and had run it for a while. A year after 9/11, on the 26th of October, 2002, Gore Vidal wrote a 7,000-word polemic titled The Enemy Within. And he writes, we still don't know by whom we were struck on that infamous Tuesday or for what purpose, but it is fairly plain to many civil libertarians that 9/11 put much of our fragile Bill of Rights, gave it a mortal blow. He argues that the real motive for the Afghanistan war was to control the gateway to Eurasia and Central Asia's energy riches. He quotes extensively from a 1997 analysis of the region by Zbigniew Brzezinski. father of Mika. But Brzezinski, if you remember, was the guy who basically controlled the Carter administration, just like Kissinger controlled the Nixon administration. Vidal argues that U.S. administrations, both Democrat and Republican, were aware that the American public would resist any war in Afghanistan to get those riches. And what are those riches? Lithium for car batteries. A lot of rare earth minerals that are being used in a lot of high-tech stuff. That's one of the reasons why, as I said, for the longest time, you would have the Pentagon saying, we're not leaving. We're going to be there, you know, 5 years ago. They're saying, we're going to be there another 20 years at least. At least. And they didn't leave. They were thrown out. Anyway, he said, Osama, this is Gore Vidal. Osama was chosen on aesthetic grounds to be the frightening logo, well put, for our long contemplated invasion and conquest of Afghanistan, because the administration was so convinced that Americans are so simple-minded that they can deal with no scenario that is any more complex than the venerable, lone, crazed killer, this time with zombie helpers. Who does it? Does evil, an evildoer. Does evil just for the fun of it, because he hates us, because we're rich and free and he's not. See? They hate us for our freedom. And who is it that hates our freedom today? Joe Biden. Now we are the terrorists. Anyway, he says, apparently conspiracy stuff is now shorthand for unspeakable truth. It is an article of faith, said Gore Vidal, that there are no conspiracies in American life. Yet a year or so ago, who would have thought that most of corporate America had been conspiring with accountants to cook their books since, well, at least the bright dawn of the era of Reagan and deregulation? He went on to say the astounding military experts cannot fathom why government's automatic standard order of procedure in the event of the hijacking was not followed. Again, Gore Vidal, his father or uncle, involved with the establishing NORAD. Gore Vidal said the procedures that were ignored determined that fighter planes should automatically be sent aloft as soon as a plane is deviated from its flight plan. Presidential authority is not required until a plane is to be shot down. But on the 11th of September, no decision to start launching planes was taken until after 9:40 a.m., 80 minutes after air controllers first knew that Flight 11 had been hijacked, 50 minutes after the first plane had struck the North Tower. By law, he said, the fighters should have been up around 8:15. If they had, all the hijacked planes might have been diverted and shot down. So they tried to fill this in after the fact, and they said, well, you know, we were doing a training exercise that day. And it made, interestingly enough, the training exercise was exactly like the real event. And we've seen that a couple of times as well, too. Having a training exercise to confuse the people responding, is this a training exercise or is this the real thing? And there was a lot of confusion that day because they did that. How did, you know, what an amazing question. Like I said, they want to call us conspiracy theorists, but, you know, when we talk about people who are dying of, oh, it's just a coincidence, the vaccine, it's just a coincidence that they had the vaccine shot and then they got a heart attack and dropped over dead. It's just a coincidence. It's just a coincidence that we happen to be doing exactly the same scenario. They did it on the 7/7 bombings in the UK as well. And you know, they just happened to be doing a training exercise about that exact same scenario at exactly the same time in exactly the same place, and it turned out to be real. That's one of their favorite methods to do that. He goes on to say, asks why Bush, as commander-in-chief, stayed in a Florida classroom. As news of the attacks broke, the behavior of President Bush on 11 September certainly gives rise to unnatural suspicions, not unnatural suspicions. He says, asking whether these failures to act expeditiously were down to conspiracy, coincidence, or error. Vidal says that incompetence would usually lead to reprimands for those responsible. It's interesting how often in our history, when disaster strikes, incompetence is considered to be a better alibi. You know, that was one of the things that that Tony Rook talked about in the UK. He said, if these buildings did collapse in a short period of time because of a fire, why haven't we had a change in firefighting procedures for putting out fires in skyscrapers? Why haven't we had an investigation of the building codes? Why haven't we changed building codes? Why hasn't anybody been sued? And that's exactly what Gore Vidal was saying. He says if it was just complete incompetence and dereliction of duty and they didn't put anything up for an hour and a half, why didn't anybody get called on the carpet for that? He said the truth about Pearl Harbor is obscured to this day, but it's been very much studied. But the 11th of September, it is plain, is never going to be investigated. Every nation knows how, if it has the means and the will to protect itself from the thugs of the sort that brought us 9/11, you can put a price on their heads and you can hunt them down. In recent years, Italy has been doing that with the Sicilian Mafia, said Gore Vidal. No one has ever suggested bombing Palermo. You identify these people. You hunt them down as individuals. So when we look at this moving forward, 20 years after the fact, have we gotten any closure? Have we done any investigations? Have we changed building codes, firefighting procedures? Have we disciplined the military who didn't do their jobs? Have we convicted the criminals, for example? 20 years after 9/11, mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is still awaiting trial. NBC News says, what went wrong? Well, they don't want a trial. They don't want to have discovery. They don't want this to be heard. And so what you have is, they said, 2 decades later, 9 years after the war crimes charges were filed, you have nothing but pretrial wrangling that is going on, the case against the guy that has been, we've been told, is the 9/11 mastermind, Sheikh Mohammed, and 4 other defendants. It marked KSM's first court appearance in more than a year. No trial date has been set, and none is anticipated. Yet. Here we are 20 years later. Oh, yeah, we don't have a trial date. We don't anticipate doing one. Defense lawyers say there's one main reason why so much has been shrouded in secrecy. They say the government is still trying to hide the details of what happened to the detainees who were held and tortured by the CIA. Gina Haspel, who covered up, appointed to be the head of the CIA by Trump. Those who were held and tortured by the CIA in secret prisons before they were transferred to Gitmo. Psychologists who got tens of millions of dollars. Even the civil lawsuits were shut down against those guys. John Kiriakou, who was a whistleblower who exposed it, the only one who was punished. Gina Haspel, who covered it up, promoted to head of the CIA by Trump. Covering up torture is the reason these two men were brought to the Gitmo, and continuing cover up of torture is the reason that indefinite detention at Gitmo still exists, said the lawyer for them. Of course, there may be other things that are even more damaging. And that it would be the truth about 9/11. Meanwhile, the New York Times estimates that it costs taxpayers about $13 million per prisoner per year to keep them there. And there's at least 5 of them. No problem. Just print some more. Just call up the Federal Reserve. Tell them to do it. Some families of 9/11 victims were watching it and they were disgusted. They said they started arguing about a cushion. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's lawyer said that he had asked for a cushion for the van ride from the detention center to the courtroom, and he hadn't received it. And the government said, yes, he had been provided a cushion. And they went back and forth arguing about whether or not he'd had a cushion on the van ride. My sister looked at me and said, 3,000 people died, and they're arguing about a cushion. And she got up and walked off. Spike Lee did a series, this multi-part series on HBO. It's really about New York. And the final episode, he spends a little bit of time talking about 9/11. You know, he's got a lot of interviews with de Blasio, with AOC, with Schumer. By the way, he doesn't have any with Cuomo, or they were on the cutting room floor. But he did want to talk a little bit about 9/11 because he thought that that was something that really was a big effect with New York City. Everybody thinks about that. As we approach the 20th anniversary of September 11th, you have Representative Lee Zeldin is just furious, and so is Breitbart, that Spike Lee or anybody would examine this. And let me say, why is it that we have people, you know, most of the skeptics of 9/11 are on the left, the celebrity skeptics, I should say. You know, not the people like architects and engineers or the pilots for 9/11 Truth or the people I'm going to be talking to in just a couple of minutes here. Or me. I mean, we're not leftists. But you had a lot of celebrities come out. It was safe for them to question this because it was Bush, and they didn't like Bush. So you have Gore Vidal. You now got Spike Lee. But even the leftists pay a penalty. You had Ed Asner, who played Lou Grant. He just recently passed in his 90s. He courageously narrated stuff for Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry and other things. He was genuinely a skeptic, and he held firm to all of that. And he was not going to be intimidated by people in terms of not doing that. He died at 91, just within this last week or so. But Lee Zeldin is not happy that anybody would question this. We should not be investigating the deaths of 3,000 people. You just listen to what the government says. And you listen to what the government says about the deaths of 13,000 people registered in the VAERS event. All these other people who are... So I just call it the legend of Zeldin, right? He's got this little legend, and he doesn't want anybody questioning the legend of Zeldin. And look, this guy has had some good stuff. He's been against mask mandates and vaccine mandates. But the thing that is at the epicenter of all this must not be challenged. He said, as we approach the 20th anniversary, it's revolting that people like Spike Lee continue to peddle debunked conspiracy theories about this horrific day. Even more disturbing that Democrat politicians continue to openly embrace his support. He said, Spike Lee's support is dishonoring the memory of so many New Yorkers that we lost on September 11th and twisting a knife into the wounds of the families they left behind. You know what twists a knife in the families they left behind? The fact that you've got the guy that they identify as the mastermind. They don't want to do a trial with him. Or the fact that they want to cover up information about who else might be involved. Is it the Saudis? Is it the Israelis? As a matter of fact, the picture that they put in here, of all things, on Breitbart. Here is Representative Lee Zeldin speaking during an event hosted by the Zionist Organization of America. Why did Breitbart put that in there? the families that they left behind want truth about what happened. That's what that family in the UK wants. They want the people responsible for this. They know that the lies that have been told about this are not possible. So the final episode of Spike Lee's series, and I think it was 8 of them or something, had some moments there where he talked to architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, identified by Breitbart. I'm just so fed up with Breitbart. They're cheerleading for vaccines and the rest of this stuff. Nick Nolte is just off the rails. They have lost any connection to liberty if they ever had one. They've become hyper-partisan and just completely incapable of understanding what is really going on here. Or if they understand it, they're complicit with it. Anyway, the conspiracy group, architects and engineers, says Breitbart. Spike Lee said, I've got questions. I hope that maybe the legacy of this documentary is that Congress holds a congressional hearing about 9/11, he told the New York Times. He said, the amount of heat that it takes to make steel melt, the temperature is not reached. Then the juxtaposition of the way that Building 7 fell to the ground, when you put it next to other building collapses that were demolitions, it's like you're looking at the same thing. That's right. But people are going to make up their own minds. We have Silverstein says pull it. You have firefighters said, we heard control, boom, 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 boom. Like I said, that's just the floors hitting each other as they're pancaking down. No, it fell in free fall all at once. As a matter of fact, I was in New York at that site with Jakari. We were doing another report, and they had a tour group come by. And it was like Silverstein Square or something. It set up a memorial to the guy who demolished the building, who owned Building 7 and demolished it. And so I was listening for a while to the lies that they were telling the crowd there, and I just couldn't take it anymore. I lost it, lost my temper, and I started yelling, what actually happened? But anyway, it happens to me sometimes. Anyway, but he said Spike Lee, people are going to make up their own mind. My approach is to put the information in the movie and let people decide for themselves. I respect the intelligence of the audience. So now is the thing. New York epicenter is 9/11 to 2021 and a half. Again, he talks to these politicians and so forth. Then he starts getting hit again by Breitbart, by Washington Examiner. Spike Lee and HBO are spreading disinformation. Will they be banned next? And then the next thing we see from Breitbart is after the backlash, Spike Lee is re-editing HBO 9/11 documentary. And the headline says, featuring debunked conspiracy theories. No, they're not debunked. The only conspiracy theory that's been debunked is the official story from the government. They say the final episode reportedly included conspiracy group architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth who believe the tragedy was a result of a controlled demolition, reported Variety. And then he tweets out, he says, I'm back in the editing room. Looking at the eighth and final chapter of New York City Epicenters, I respectfully ask you to hold your judgment until you see the final cut. He devotes 30 minutes near the very end of the series to relitigating arguments that have been debunked 1,000 times, wrote a guy at Slate Magazine. He said the final episode was a bit like presenting COVID-19 vaccine skeptics in a debate alongside Anthony Fauci. We would never allow that, would we? We would never allow a debate between, Kerry Mullis, who invented the PCR. We wouldn't allow a debate between him and Fauci. Fauci would never sign up for that. Kerry said, I've challenged him to debate many times, tried to organize it at a university. He's telling people lies about what this PCR test can do, and he said that in the context of the HIV-AIDS controversy. So we'd never have a debate between the guy who invented the PCR test and won a Nobel Prize for it and Anthony Fauci. We'd never have a debate between people who have treated people with other things like ivermectin off-label or have criticisms about the vaccine. No, we'd never have that. He said, or we'd never imagine that you're going to have a clique of climate change deniers alongside the authors of the UN IPCC report. This is a guy, Stahl, who writes for Slate. In other words, no debates. Believe your government, obey your government, never question your government. And then Breitbart quotes John Nolte, who's become a big cheerleader for the vaccines. Oh, yeah, I'm all vaxxed up, and everybody ought to get vaxxed up. But I just have a little bit of a problem with some of these mandates. But, yeah, they're great things, that type of stuff from John Nolte. John Nolte of Breitbart News, says Breitbart, said of Lee's docuseries and his planning airing of conspiracy theories, I don't think Spike Lee respects much of anything, most especially the intelligence of the audience. First off, we've already had congressional investigations on this. See, the authorities have spoken. You see how different Breitbart is from Slate? Yeah, exactly. We don't have to have a debate on science. It's settled. We got authorities who tell us that the world is melting. We got authorities who tell us, get the shot. This is not about freedom. It's not about your choice. You're going to get the shot. Shut up. And you're being told that by people like Breitbart as well. So we don't need to investigate 9/11 or any of these things. You just do what the government tells you. He said, secondly, this idea that a fire can't collapse a building is just profoundly stupid. He said, it's almost as stupid as believing that jet fuel fire can't reach a high enough temperature to... Oh, you get my point. Well, here's the point. As I said before, this building in Milan burns for a day. Burns everything away except for the steel infrastructure. It doesn't fall. But, hey, what do I know? Just listen to Breitbart and Slate.
Has your news been censored, banned over and over again? Has vital information been held prisoner by mainstream and anti-social media? It's the duty of every thinking person to make the great escape to thedavidknightshow.com. There you'll find links to live streams, videos, audio podcasts, and support links. Live stream the show at DLive and Trovo every Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern. Videos at BitChute and YouTube. New audio podcast, The Real David Knight Show, at Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, iHeart, Spotify, and more. But even though there's a light at the end of the tunnel, without your support, the show will run out of gas. The links to support the show are at thedavidknightshow.com. To donate via Subscribestar, donate via or donate via Cash App, Bitcoin, or P.O. Box. Our sincere thanks to all of you who have stood with us to get this far. Please don't forget to share the links and pray for the country
as well as our family.
We're coming back in about 10 seconds.
Hear news now at APSradionews.com or get the APS Radio app and never miss another story.
Okay, all right. Okay, joining us now, we have David Meiswinkel. He is the president and executive director of Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, and this is a very, very busy time for him. I was just talking to him off air, and he said they were up till 3 o'clock last night. They've got events coming up tomorrow. And, of course, they've been working on this for decades. But, you know, this is the 20th anniversary, and so everybody wants to revisit this and talk about this, and we always need to take the opportunity to talk about what I believe and what I've been saying for the last hour and a half is a seminal false flag event that has been used to alter our society in so many different ways. So joining us now is David Meiswinkel, President and Executive Director of Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you, David, for having us.
Tell me a little bit about what's coming up. You've got an event that is coming up tomorrow in case people want to follow that as well. Tell us about that first.
Right, they can get get connected to that at lc4for911.org. We'll be doing a 9/11 20th anniversary event, a commemoration. Ed Asner was going to do the welcome, and as you know, Ed just passed. He was a board member of ours.
Yes,
and so we'll be dedicating the event to him and also to the victims of 9/11 and their families. We'll have a little. Dedication at the beginning of the program. But we have Rainer Fuhlmisch. He'll be calling in from Germany. You know, he's doing a lot on the with regards to the COVID and the alleged pandemic
we're
experiencing. And there'll be speakers that can connect that. Whitney Webb, she's an investigative journalist. She'll be talking about the parallels between 9/11, anthrax, and the present pandemic. We'll have people that will strictly talk about the 9/11 itself. Commissioner Joy, a fire commissioner, he'll be there. Bob McElvain, who lost his son in the North Tower, he'll be speaking. Graham McQueen, who is a professor from Canada of 30 years, expert in 9/11. Kevin Ryan, a whistleblower, a scientist. And others, there'll be Merle Nass, she's an expert in anthrax. She'll be talking. Francis Boyle, who is actually the world's expert on biotreaties. He developed in 1989 the United States bioweapons treaty, at least his language. And Mick Harrison will be there, myself, or Barbara Honecker from our committee, William Jacoby. And as I mentioned, I think I did, James Corbett will be presenting also. And I hope I didn't forget anyone. I think that's most of the people. But we'll be talking about a lot of important issues, beginning with 9/11, of course, and connecting it with the anthrax attacks, which happened at basically the same time as a bioweapon attack, and with what some perceive as a bioweapon attack right now in reference to the COVID, and the vaccines may be even worse.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And of course, you're mentioning, do we lose him? It kind of froze up there. I think we still got him on. Are you still there, David? Can you hear us? I think you need to recontact with him. Of course, he talked about Rainer Fulmick in Germany, Francis Boyle in the U.S., and other connections. Is he back? Are you back? Nope, we're still getting him. Okay, other connections.
I'm here, David.
Okay, good, he's with us. Okay, good.
Yeah, this is Mick.
Oh, okay, Mick. Good. Thank you for joining us, Mick. And you're working on litigation. I was just saying the people that are being brought into this, and I've talked to you before. I've talked to David before about the connection with the anthrax attacks and the new investigations that you guys are doing in that. And I think they're very tightly linked between these two things. But even if you don't see the linkage, you see the parallel usage of this. Talk to us. You're the litigation director for the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. Tell us a little bit about some of the upcoming litigation. We just heard from David about the events tomorrow on the 20th anniversary. Tell us about litigation.
Right. I think we have David back, by the way.
Okay, good.
How you doing,
right.
Mick? How you doing?
Okay, good. We got both of you on now. Okay, but tell us a little bit about litigation, Mick Harrison.
All right. So we have a petition before the U.S. Supreme Court at the moment that some folks don't know about. The Supreme Court has not yet decided to hear the case on the merits, but it's on a petition for certiorari that's been docketed. So this is regarding our lawsuit against the FBI and the Department of Justice. The lawsuit was filed in D.C. It related to a second 9/11 commission that a lot of folks don't know about, the 2013, 2014, 2015 9/11 Review Commission, which was chaired by Ed Meese. And the purpose of that commission was to evaluate all evidence regarding 9/11 that the original commission had not looked at. Now, Congress issued a mandate in 2013 for the FBI to do this new study of all the evidence. The reason we sued them was that it was basically a whitewash. They didn't look at the new evidence. They just pretended to look at the new evidence.
Wow.
So we looked at, all the evidence of the demolition of the Trade Center towers we talked about before. We looked at a number of other categories of evidence, including the Saudi connection, which is in litigation, as everyone knows probably now, in New York for the families.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was the district court decided that whether we were right or not about the evidence and whether we were right or not about what Congress intended, that because Congress didn't put its explicit intent about doing this report to evaluate all the evidence into the actual language of the bill, but just put it in legislative history, which was abundantly clear, that basically the FBI didn't have to issue a report to anybody about this study, including the Congress itself, and therefore we had no standing to enforce the requirement.
So they created a review commission, but since the court says, well, since they didn't have anything saying that they had to do anything, you don't have any standing to say why didn't they do anything. They just there was no purpose to the commission then, right?
Yeah, I mean, it cost a couple of $1 million to the taxpayers, but they didn't have to report their findings to anyone, even about the worst crime in the history of this country, terrorist crime. So we found it basically an irrational decision. We appealed it to the D.C. Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. Unfortunately, that Court of Appeals issued a decision under some unusual circumstances that agreed with the district court that we didn't have standing. Those unusual circumstances included participation on our 3-judge panel by a judge who is now the Attorney General of the United States, Merrick Garland. In other words, the judge who is now heading the agency we were suing. And what happened with that was that we had oral arguments scheduled in the case after we'd briefed it. And Judge Garland participated in the decision shortly after that to take away the oral argument, to rescind the scheduling of the oral argument. And then the decision was issued as an unpublished decision, which got a lot less of fanfare. And in the meantime, Judge Garland was publicly being considered as a nominee to become Attorney General during the same time, and did become, of course, the nominee and was confirmed. We asked for the D.C. Circuit to do a disclosure of exactly when Judge Garland knew he was a nominee to become Attorney General in the suit, during the suit we were litigating against the agency he was to become the head of, and the court refused to disclose any facts. So that is also now, in addition to the standing question, an issue before the U.S. Supreme Court. So I'll stop there. We have other litigation, but I'll let you ask questions or go to David.
So yeah, what you're talking about then is essentially you're saying a conflict of interest for him because of his involvement there, being put in as head of the Department of Justice, and then they're coming back and saying that you have no standing and that, of course, nobody had any standing to do anything with this commission. Is that kind of an accurate summary of this, more or less?
It is, and that includes, as David is often explaining, that we had a family member, Bob McElvain, as a plaintiff in that case, and the court decided that even he did not have standing to complain that the 9/11 evidence wasn't evaluated as Congress mandated. The conflict of interest issue is a little more disturbing even than you framed it, David, because under the law, a judge has to recuse themselves to withdraw from a case, even if there's an appearance of impropriety, and that legal standard doesn't turn on what the judge knew at a particular point in time. It turns on what the public knew. And because the public knew that Judge Garland was a candidate to become Attorney General from press reports during the time he was on our panel making the decision to take away our oral argument, which led to the unpublished decision, There's not too much of a question in our mind that that standard was violated.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if the public knows it and everybody's talking about it in the papers, of course he's going to know it too. He doesn't live in a vacuum or under a rock. He's going to know that everybody's got it. You know, his name is up for that. And, of course, they've been talking to him about that before. It's absolutely amazing as we see this being pushed to the side. I talked earlier about the fact that, Sheikh Khalid Mohammed is 20 years and they still haven't had a trial about that. It's just amazing how they have swept everything aside, swept it under the carpet. But, you know, we had a lot of suspicious activity surrounding the anthrax attack that, David, as you mentioned earlier, it happened right alongside that. You know, we had a simulation, Dark Winter, that is exactly the formula for what has been done to us for the last year and a half, run by by Johns Hopkins and the CDC and the usual suspects. And then 2 months later, you have 9/11. And a week after that, you have the anthrax attack. And then 2 months later, you get the legislation sent out to all the various places. Talk about the anthrax attack. I've had you on a few months ago, and you had there was a lot of skepticism about the sloppy investigation work that was done at the time, put in by the mainstream media like New York Times, Washington Post, and others. But you have opened this back up. And you guys have done your own investigation. You found, dug deeper, talked to people who were there at the time, and it is far worse than what people talked about in the aftermath of that with the New York Times and Washington Post. Tell the audience a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's correct, David. We believe that Bruce Ivins, who was a scientist that worked at USIMRID, was basically an innocent man, that the evidence wasn't there to convict him at all. And that the investigation was obstructed by the FBI and corrupted, that they lied to Congress and misled them. We believe that the suspects, at least the line of thinking, would have been up through Dugway Proving Grounds and Patel Memorial, who had secret contracts at that time with the CIA. This anthrax was the most sophisticated anthrax that was ever seen at that time in this country, and that that was a trillion spores per gram. That was what was sent to Senators, U.S. Senators Leahy and Daxel. We've asked, and Mick is about ready on behalf of the Lawyers Committee, because we just met last night. We're ready to file a new paper, and he can update you on that. It's going to be with it down in Washington. It's going to be with the U.S. attorney there asking for a grand jury petition on this whole matter. We submitted it earlier to Congress, so Congress now is up to date on it. We're going to update the U.S. attorney, but we're also going to be asking for a special counsel. And Mitt might be able to go into that, because we believe there's a conflict of interest that the Justice Department cannot investigate itself because of this obvious conflict of interest. We believe that the smoking gun... Oh, Dave, you were going to say something. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to say, you know, just to give people an overview of what happened, if I recall it correctly, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but when this first came out, they were saying, well, this is coming from Iraq, and we need to go attack Iraq, and then they realized, as you pointed out, this is very, very sophisticated, so this couldn't be Iraq. And not only that, but it was a particular type of weaponization that could have only come from two places. Both of those had connections with the CIA, but instead they focused on a third lab, and then they focused on a person at that third lab, Bruce Ivins, and they came after him for years. They eventually said that he committed suicide, so case solved, and we stop it. And so you had a lot of media that was concerned about that. You guys went back and you interviewed people that had worked with Bruce Ivins, and you pointed out, as you were just talking about, the fact that it was very, very sophisticated, highly weaponized, that it could only have been done at these two places that were not investigated. And so now what is happening with this in terms of a legal standpoint?
Well, Mick, you want to follow that?
Sure, Dave, thanks. So tomorrow, at the latest, we're going to file a grand jury petition with the U.S. Attorney in the District of Columbia. But as Dave says, we're also going to ask the Attorney General, who happens to be Merrick Garland, former Judge Garland we were talking about, we're going to ask him to appoint a special counsel to handle our petition and the grand jury inquiry for the very reason that Dave articulated, which is the FBI and Department of Justice should not be asked to investigate themselves. Now, why do we say they would be investigating themselves and the anthrax attacks? Well, that's an important question. It's detailed and documented in both our petition to Congress and in our grand jury petition coming up. The short version, David, is, as you may remember, the FBI focused on Dr. Ivins after discarding other suspects that they couldn't prove up a case against. And the argument they made against Dr. Ivins was primarily a DNA evidence-based argument. And what they were saying was that they did, at the time, state-of-the-art DNA testing, called PCR testing, of anthrax samples from 20 or so labs around the country. And they said that the only lab that had what they called the fingerprint morphs, which were certain DNA patterns that the FBI found in their tests. They said the only lab that had the match for the fingerprint morphs was Dr. Ivins' lab at Fort Detrick in Maryland. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with that, as we discovered in our investigation, is the FBI covered up evidence that would have pointed to the facilities you mentioned, which would be Battelle and Dugway, Dugway Proving Ground, the Army's facility in Utah. And they did that in a very clever way that very few people would have picked up on. And we had to dig in the details, not only of the Army's evidence and the FBI's evidence, but also the National Research Council's evidence, the NRC. And they did a report on this, paid for by the FBI, but it didn't turn out to be very flattering to the FBI. Okay, so what happened was that somebody in the FBI decided, or maybe one of their consultants, that they would only look at samples if they were what we call viable samples or live samples. It also turns out, conveniently for Dugway, that the samples they provided to the FBI of their anthrax were non-viable or dead samples. And so they didn't get tested.
Oh.
Okay, now, why does that matter? Okay, it matters because Dr. Ivins' stock of anthrax, we call it RMR-1029 because that's what they called it, it's a code name. It was 85% composed of anthrax provided by Dugway and 15% anthrax that Dr. Ivins produced in his lab, which he called RMR-1030. Both of those stocks got tested, RMR-1029 and RMR-1030, and because they were at Fort Detrick, you know, they were viable samples, they got tested, and what did the FBI find in doing those tests? That Ivins' contribution to the flask at Fort Detrick did not have any of the fingerprint morphs, none of them. Hmm. But RMR-1029, which was 85% Dugway anthrax, had all of them.
Wow.
Now, think about this from the point of view of the Sherlock Holmes expression, when you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains must be the truth.
Yes.
There are only two components to that flask, Ivins and Dugway's. Ivins tested negative, the entire flask tested positive. So where did the anthrax fingerprint morphs come from in the flask? There's only one possibility left. It was Dugway.
Yeah, yeah.
But their samples didn't get tested. So that's why the FBI should not be investigating itself here, because they're involved in a cover-up with that key evidence.
Yes, yes. And so you're hoping that they're going to appoint a special prosecutor. And, of course, you know, the problem with all this is that it, again, is, you know, Merrick Garland at the epicenter of all this. But ideally, there would be, you know, in a better world, we would have, and what you're asking for, is an independent prosecutor, because the FBI are the ones that did the cover-up. Is that correct?
Well, yes. Dave may want to comment on this, but, you know, I have still some cautious optimism that Attorney General Garland will do the right thing on this and appoint the special counsel. We did not get the disclosure from the U.S. Court of Appeals, so we don't actually know what Judge Garland knew when. It's possible he participated in the initial decisions and then recused himself from the final decision on our case, which is what the decision suggests, which means he may have had that appearance of impropriety and should have recused, but he may not have had an actual conflict of interest because he didn't personally know. Mm-hmm. And so he may not have engaged in impropriety, which means he still may have an open mind about this controversy. And if that's true, he's going to do his job as Attorney General, because there is a regulation from the DOJ which says under these circumstances, a special counsel should be appointed. I think there's a reasonable chance he's just going to do his job correctly and appoint one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's a very serious case because of all the different things that were involved in terms of precedents. And, you know, we had people who died as part of those anthrax attacks. How many people died with that?
Five people died from that, David. 17 were injured. Mm. And what's key, too, in addition to what Mick said, the FBI concentrated on the fingerprint morphs. We discovered that not only was Bruce Ivins had access to that 1029, but hundreds of people did. And in addition, at Fort Detrick, their specialty was not a dry powdered anthrax, which just was very sophisticated. What they did was a wet anthrax for their vaccine studies. So this is a total different operation to order to do this. What they found was that a simulant called B. subtilis, which is really a fingerprint, and that's characteristic of Dugway Proving Ground and their fermenters. Commonly, when we looked at these studies, they were always contaminated with this B. subtilis. Then you have the silicon, which is another fingerprint. That's really indicative of Battelle and their experiments with the anthrax and their sophistication. Then there's tin and things of that nature, which are other signatures, which the FBI doesn't even mention. All they do is concentrate it as RMR-1029, which hundreds of people had access to, but they don't tell anybody that. They don't tell Congress that. They just throw everything on Ivins, Bruce Ivins. As we said, he was the scapegoat, unfortunate person for that.
Yeah. And so there's several fingerprints. Some of those had to do with the delivery mechanism. Isn't that correct?
Well,
I can speak to that, Dave, if you want.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I think the delivery mechanism you're referring to is turning the normally wet anthrax into a very fine dry powder that is easily disseminated through the air. And in this case, the mechanism turned out to be letters posted through the mail, which were much more effective in distributing anthrax than people would have guessed, because apparently the high pressure mail sorters forced the very fine anthrax particles out of the pores of the envelopes, even though they were sealed with tape.
Wow.
So the mechanism in this case, which is what Dave is explaining, is, you know, there had to be a sophisticated processing of this anthrax, which could not have been done at Fort Detrick, where Dr. Ivins was located. An interesting twist on this is initially when the FBI tried to publicly convict Ivins without a trial after his death, when he couldn't defend himself, they basically, you know, focused on, you know, we're convinced Ivins snuck around in his lab late at night and made this stuff. Well, what did the FBI say in the litigation in Florida when the Stevens family, one of the unfortunate victims of the attacks, sued, and the government's witnesses said, well, it couldn't have been negligence at Fort Detrick because we didn't have the equipment there that it could have been used to make this anthrax.
Wow.
So they essentially backed off of the accusation that Ivins could have made it at Fort Detrick. Later, in a low profile set of affidavits in the federal litigation, didn't get much press attention, but it just totally undercut their case.
So we have a situation here, you know, with murder, five people dead. There is no statute of limitations on that, but this is even bigger than that because there were so many different policy implications with this. We wound up having an anthrax vaccine that was forced on a lot of soldiers. And there were a lot of injuries or deaths with that anthrax vaccine, as well as policy implications. I would expect that this would happen, but we're not seeing any, you know, the press, by and large, is not paying any attention to this, are they? I mean, we had the New York Times and Washington Post when this was rolling out, and then again when Bruce Ivins died, you know, they covered the stories. But they're not really covering this at this point in time, are they? Or are they? Are you getting any other press coverage?
Not that I know of. Maybe Mick knows that. Basically, the press coverage is back at that time around 2008, I think, where the New York Times was talking about a new investigation. The Washington Post was saying the same thing. Congressman Nadler, Congressman Holt were asking for that. I think Senator Leahy and Grassley were asking for the same thing. But remember, they closed it down before the National Academy of Sciences made their reports. And then the Government Accountability Office made a report. Those reports did not jive with what the FBI was saying. They did not agree with them, with their science. Their science, the FBI science, was the key thing that they hung on to say that Bruce Ivins did it. But the science, even the scientists, didn't agree with them. So for that reason, it should be totally opened just for that DNA type of analysis, but for much more.
Yeah,
I think, David, to
go
answer
ahead.
Your question about the press, there was a lot of press early on, as Dave points out. the New York Times asked for a new investigation. The Washington Post asked for a new investigation. Some time has passed, and it's gotten to be more of a cold story. But we're hoping that with this new filing tomorrow, that the Washington Post and the New York Times and some of the senators will be, how should we say, reawakened on the issue. Keep in mind, this was a biological warfare agent attack on the U.S. Congress intended to assassinate two United States senators.
Yes.
Senator Leahy and Senator Daschle, at a time when they were, how should I say, raising concerns and slowing the vote on the Patriot Act. Which is an interesting coincidence, if it is a coincidence.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is very interesting. And of course, they're all about attacks on Congress. You would think that this would be a topical thing with the 20-year anniversary coming up, with the focus on domestic terrorism and insurrection. But I think that is a very significant aspect of this that you just mentioned, the fact that you got two senators who are trying, who are a bit skeptical on this Patriot Act, and they happen to be the ones that that is addressed to. I mean, it's very suspicious. Hopefully, you're going to get some traction with this. Tell us a little bit more about your organization and where can people find can they go to your website to see the events that are going to be happening tomorrow?
Sure, they can. It's lc4for911.org, and they can sign up if they want to. The event will start at 1 o'clock Eastern time, and it'll go to 9 o'clock. So there'll be continuous speakers, and they can pick that agenda up basically if they go to the website. Thank you.
Well, you guys are doing great work and very deep investigation here. And as you pointed out, there's many different conflicting stories. You have investigators came up with information that conflicts the FBI's conclusion, but they rapidly shut that down as Bruce Ivins dies apparently of suicide, and they rapidly pinned it on him and shut that investigation down before the other stuff came in. It needs to be opened up again. Has anybody done any, what about the suicide of Bruce Ivins? Has there been any, are there anything suspicious about that?
Well, you know, we talked to people, and two people very close to him believe that he was murdered, all right? So we haven't been able to file that up yet, but that's what they believe. Others say that he, they forced him to drink and to take pills or whatever, or take the Tylenol, and that he killed himself. We don't know that, but we know they put an inordinate amount of pressure on him. They made his life hell, and his family's life.
Yes, yes.
And so, David, if I could add one note to that.
Sure.
So the FBI put a lot of their documents, not all of them, but a lot of them on the web in what they call the Vault, a publicly available website. And we went through a lot of those documents in detail. One of the interesting things they show is Dr. Ivins, over a period of time during this investigation, prior to his death, was actually serving as essentially a whistleblower, pointing the FBI to who Ivins thought would have been the real suspects in the anthrax attacks, based on his inside knowledge of who would have the capability to prepare something this sophisticated in his field. Now, I'm a whistleblower lawyer. I represent whistleblowers. I've been doing it for 30 years. Looking at this pattern of evidence, it is significant, circumstantial, but significant, that Dr. Ivins dies under somewhat mysterious circumstances after he is essentially blowing the whistle to the FBI on who might really be responsible.
Wow. Wow. It is an amazing case. And we want to keep up to date with what is happening. So I want to have you back on to give us an update as to what is happening with that. Give everybody the website one more time where they can see the events tomorrow and where they can follow up on this, because this is all foundational to everything that is happening to our country right now. What is that website again?
It's lc4for911.org.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining us, and we certainly hope that you're successful in this. We need to have answers, and we need to have closure on these. Thank you so much. And just a couple of seconds that we've got left, I want to remind people, as we're talking about thousands of people, 3,000 plus, dying on 9/11. Another five people dying with anthrax attacks after that. Thousands of people dying, American soldiers dying in Afghanistan, people injured with anthrax vaccines. I mean, the death and destruction that has gone on with this is just amazing. And people are still dying. People are still dying. People who were first responders at Ground Zero. People who were sent in without proper masks and ventilation, to remove the debris quickly, to essentially cover this up. 20 years later, you've got people still dying of cancer, dying of COPD. In a review of nearly 18,000 workers and volunteers who climbed in the ruins in the hours and the days following the attacks, and remember, we had officials like Rudy Giuliani and others telling everybody, go ahead, it's safe, right? Researchers from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai discovered many have begun to develop COPD after previous asthma diagnosis. COPD is a chronic lung condition. Causes breathing difficulties, coughing, wheezing. It only gets worse over time. And I've had a listener who used to call in for years at InfoWars, a victim of this. We still have the Victim Compensation Fund. It's still offering relief to 9/11 survivors. The death and destruction continues. The police state surveillance continues to escalate. And the contempt for our liberty still demonstrated by people like Joe Biden and the vaccine program. The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project, to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. thedavidknightshow.com.